Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
A new museum focused on an inclusive and comprehensive history of the U.S. Civil War opens this weekend in Richmond, Virginia, the former capital of the Confederacy. As Mallory Nopain of member station WVTF reports, it's a timely look at history that has loomed large in recent events.
If we step on into the gallery...
Construction on the museum began in 2017, just days after white supremacists rallied around a statue of Robert E. Lee in Charlottesville, turning into a deadly confrontation. Now, the opening comes as a blackface scandal still hovers over Virginia's governor. Museum Chief Christy Coleman says it's past time for Americans to set aside myths about the Civil War and its aftermath and confront the realities.
You know, I've said this more times than enough now. We'll never get right with each other if we don't get the history right.
The new American Civil War Museum aims to do just that. It's unprecedented in its attempt to tell the entire story of the war, not just from the northern and southern perspectives, but through the eyes of women, immigrants, Native Americans, and enslaved African Americans.
The old master didn't tell no one they was free. The Yankees went there and turned us loose.
Letters are read aloud with a sense of immediacy and drama. Photographs are life-sized and in color.
They turned us out just like cattle.
And old artifacts are displayed in new context, made possible by combining the former Museum of the Confederacy's extensive collection with the latest scholarship and research.
Let's make this story fresh. Let's make it relevant. Let's make it exciting. Let's make it terrifying.
Civil War historian Ed Ayers is one of the museum's founders. He says many Americans have lost a sense of the depth and suffering of the war.
We've domesticated the Civil War. We've turned it into kind of a hobby. People don't say, I'm a Holocaust buff.
The new $25 million museum doesn't romanticize the history.
So we're going to go up and we'll look out over the river here and over the ruin wall.
The building overlooks the James River, where enslaved Africans were brought here by boat. Chief Curator Kathy Wright makes it clear the Civil War was fought over that human cargo.
So we felt, you know, we're not going to sit here and go down this road of debate about states' rights and westward expansion or any of these other things. It's slavery, full stop.
That directness might challenge some people's notions of the war, but that's the point, says CEO Christy Coleman.
This idea that we can't re-examine or give the fullness of the story of our past is problematic. It's extremely problematic.
Coleman is a historian, and she's part of a committee that advised the city of Richmond to add context to the Confederate monuments that still stand just a couple miles away. Coleman hopes that by learning the nation's history in all its complexity and humanity, people will be more prepared to confront today's challenges.
I think we stand a better chance of acknowledging that we still have a lot of work to do. It's not hopeless, but it's possible.
In the final days of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln called on Americans to bind up the nation's wounds. Now, a century and a half later, the American Civil War Museum is open, and historians are playing their part in that continuous effort. For NPR News, I'm Mallory Nopain in Richmond, Virginia.
And so, they called me the new Black Hitler. Like I have some wicked vendetta against Jewish people.
The story right now is about Facebook and who does and does not get to be on that platform. According to Facebook, there is a new list of people who cannot, and that includes right-wing conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. Facebook has banned them because they are, quote, dangerous individuals. That's according to Facebook. We should mention that Facebook is a financial supporter of NPR. And this move comes as the social media giant and other social media companies face withering criticism for allowing hate speech and false information to spread and influence their users, especially in the run-up, obviously, to the 2016 elections. Paris Martineau covers social media and internet culture for Wired magazine and joins us from our studios in New York.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Hi, Paris. So exactly who are we talking about? Who was banned?
Yeah, so on Thursday afternoon, Facebook banned six high-profile extremists and one conspiracy theorist site that includes inflammatory figureheads in the far right like Laura Loomer, InfoWars' Alex Jones, and Paul Joseph Watson, as well as white supremacist Paul Nellen and radical Muslim preacher Louis Farrakhan.
So President Trump and other conservatives have accused various social media companies for censoring right-wing opinions. Alex Jones, Milo Yiannopoulos, Louis Farrakhan, they've been around for a long time. So why is Facebook doing this now?
So a Facebook spokesperson told me that the company has always banned individuals and organizations that promote or engage in violence and hate, regardless of ideology. But the people and organization banned Thursday were just as extreme and peddled just as much misinformation and hate a year ago as they did Thursday.
Hmm. What's been the fallout from this?
The fallout has largely been the people banned protesting their ban. There was a bit of a snafu in the fact that Facebook kind of seeded a number of media outlets on Thursday afternoon with this story in advance, then struggled to actually take down the accounts at the time the media outlets published the story, allowing these extremist figureheads to publish on their banned, soon-to-be-banned Instagram accounts. Follow me on the other platform.
Huh. So is this, I mean, is this setting a precedent? Are we going to see Facebook continue to ban accounts? And who makes those decisions?
Those are all great questions. I think that Facebook is, like Facebook often does, going to do whatever it wants. And it'll be interesting to see how it continues to apply this going forward, whether it'll stick with it.
Okay, lots of questions still. Paris Martineau, social media reporter at Wired. Thanks, we appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You know, first ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
On Saturday morning, a gunman opened fire at the Chabad of Poway Synagogue in Southern California, where the congregation was gathered on the final day of Passover. One woman was killed and three others were injured. The shooter was white, and he reportedly yelled anti-Semitic language when he entered the synagogue. The attack came 6 weeks after a shooter killed 50 people at two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, and 6 months to the day from the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where 11 people were killed. All three attacks have digital connections, online forums that provide a place for hate to thrive and which have inspired terrorism. Before the Poway shooting, a user claiming to be the gunman apparently posted a link to a manifesto on the online message board 8chan.
8chan is a fairly large website, and a number of things go on there.
Robert Evans is an investigative journalist with the research collective Bellingcat.
8chan's poll board is where this person and the Christchurch shooter both announced the start of their massacre. And poll is essentially a neo-Nazi gathering place on the internet. And the goal of the users there is to radicalize each other further and further and eventually convince other people to carry out attacks like this.
So if these sites are breeding hate, the question is whether enough is being done to track and respond to the spread of white nationalism online. Since taking office, President Trump has cut funding to an Obama-era program designed to combat domestic terrorism. To put all this in context, we turn to Hannah Block Wiebe, an assistant professor of law at Drexel University, and Robert Evans, the investigative journalist we heard from earlier. Robert started by laying out the evidence connecting the shooter with the 8chan post.
The post includes a link to the manifesto. The manifesto has the shooter's name in it, and the name has been, you know, confirmed pretty early on. The language is all sort of what you'd expect for a case like this. It included a live stream link, which thankfully did not work for very long. It's just it was a pretty open and shut case as far as I'm concerned.
Robert, 8chan tweeted on Sunday about the original post, and I'll read you what they said. They said the Poway shooter's post on 8chan was taken down 9 minutes after creation. There are only screen caps available and no archives exist since the post was deleted so quickly. The loudest groups publicizing this crime and giving attention to this criminal are the fake news media. That's 8chan quoting their tweet there. Walk us through the response, Robert. What are they trying to say?
Oh, they're trying to say that they're not responsible because they deleted the original post. But when I got onto 8chan's poll board about an hour or so after the shooting, there were numerous people, other users of the site, posting screen grabs of the initial post that the shooter made, as well as sharing his manifesto and sharing the Christchurch shooter's manifesto and the video of the Christchurch shooter shooting. And in fact, when I started reporting on these people, I mean, I've been reporting on them for years, but when I reported on them in the wake of the Christchurch shooting, they first off sent off a death threat to me and put a bounty on my head. But they also would repeatedly post links to the video of the Christchurch shooting and the shooter's manifesto and brag to me that I could never get it taken down, that it was going to continue spreading on the internet and they were going to keep spreading it. And they're going to do the same thing with the Poway shooter's manifesto. Like the fact that the leadership of the site claims that they took down the post quickly is meaningless because they knew quite well that other users would continue to spread everything this person had posted.
Hannah, I want to bring you in here because just listening to what Robert was saying about 8chan's response here, how do we explain how sites like 8chan are able to even stay up after posting content like this?
So under U.S. law, under the Communications Decency Act, an online forum can't be held liable for the unlawful content that its users post.
Cannot, correct?
Cannot. So what the government can actually do to prevent 8chan from continuing to enable these postings is highly limited. The U.S. government can't take the forum offline. It can't even take a specific sub-forum offline, and nor can it block access to the website, even though my understanding is that other governments around the world, including New Zealand and Australia, have done so.
Let's talk a little bit about the distinction also, which is there's a legal distinction between hate speech and true threats of violence. How does the law distinguish between those two? Because in my mind, one leads to the other in many instances.
Right. So the U.S. Supreme Court has held that hate speech is entitled to First Amendment protection, and Nazi speech is also entitled to First Amendment protection. Speech that incites violence, true threats, speech integral to criminal conduct are not protected. So the problem here is that you're absolutely right. It's difficult to draw boundaries between all of these categories, but the law that we have does attempt to draw these boundaries, even though sometimes one category of speech that's presumptively protected can provoke speech that is then unprotected and even outright violence, as we saw in this case.
Robert, let's talk about that distinction here. How do you interpret that?
You know, there was a case in Oregon in I think the mid to late 90s, the murder of a young immigrant named Mulugeta Sarraw. And the murder was directly inspired and provoked by a guy named Tom Metzger, who was the head of a neo-Nazi organization called White Aryan Resistance. And Metzger did not kill Seurat or directly order his death, but he did radicalize the young men who beat him to death and urge them to commit crimes like the killing of Mulugeta Seurat. And Metzger was eventually convicted of, I think the term used was vicarious responsibility for the crime. And he was sued for several million dollars successfully. Being able to do that to the owners or people running 8chan would be like, I don't think that the current law is set up to allow that. But in my mind, at least, if you're looking morally at what's going on this site, it is kind of the same thing. There's less of a direct hierarchy than there was with white Aryan resistance, but there's certainly the same incitement to violence going on. So I think that what they're doing, I think that the people running the site, certainly, I would say, at least morally, have a vicarious responsibility for these shootings.
Hannah, is the government, is the U.S. government taking the threat of white nationalist online communities seriously enough now that we've seen the evidence that these communities have incited actual violence?
I don't think so. I think this attack should motivate the government to take white nationalist and white supremacist violence much more seriously as a threat to public safety, public order, and particularly to vulnerable groups. But instead, what we've seen is that there doesn't appear to have been a consistent effort or consistent successful effort to prevent these violent attacks. And instead, this is the second synagogue attack in 6 months. So to my mind, that means that the government should be using many more tools that it has at its disposal in order to prevent these violent acts from occurring.
Robert, I'm wondering here, there was a similar post made on 8chan by the shooter who killed 50 people in Christchurch, New Zealand, 6 weeks ago. The man who killed 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue was also celebrated on 8chan. Why aren't we asking where these folks are radicalized? Why do we use different language for domestic terrorists versus folks on the outside?
I mean, that's a very good question. And we don't all use different language within sort of the countering violent extremism community. The issue of sort of how Islamic terrorists are radicalized online and how right wing terrorists are radicalized online, it's very similar. And we speak about them in similar ways, but they're dealt with very differently by our legal system and dealt with very differently by law enforcement. You know, Lieutenant Christopher Hassan, the Coast Guard member who was planning a massacre that seems fairly similar to some of these other massacres and was inspired by a lot of the same people. You know, he cited Anders Breivik as an inspiration for the massacre he was planning, who the Christchurch shooter and the Poway shooter also cited. Lieutenant Hassan was only caught before committing his massacre because he was buying drugs illegally online. And it looks like right now he's about to be let out early because the judge says they don't have enough to charge him with terrorism, even though he wrote out clearly on his work computer that he was planning a terroristic massacre.
Robert, I'm going to pause there because, Hannah, yeah. Given this example, the government doesn't have enough?
What the government has in order to charge Hassan might not be more than his posts online. And I think if we're looking to simple sort of online posts or manifestos without more, it sets a troubling precedent for the idea that the government could charge anyone for a crime based on something they've written. Obviously, there's sometimes a very strong connection between those writings and acts of violence. But where the government has investigated and hasn't turned up enough to have probable cause to charge someone, that suggests to me that either they're not doing their jobs or there really isn't anything there to support the idea that an attack was actually going to take place.
Robert, your thoughts on that? And should the government, what should the government do about sites like 8chan, in your opinion?
I mean, it's difficult to say, you know, when somebody writes out on a computer, I'm planning to kill these people, this is my goal, and I'm stock. And we also know that they're stockpiling weaponry. But it's not illegal to stockpile weaponry. It's not illegal to stockpile ammunition. It's not illegal to write out on your own private Word document plans to massacre people. So I agree, it's very difficult legally to charge these people. And I don't know what exactly is the solution to that going forward. But I will say, if Christopher Hassan was an Islamic extremist and had been planning an attack in that vein, I suspect more would be done. And I suspect more would be done to keep him behind bars. As far as what can be done to deal with this problem of online radicalization, I don't think anyone has a solid answer to that yet. I mean, I would like to see these gathering places no longer up and available. But that's almost an impossible goal because there's numerous web hosts all around the planet, many of whom would be happy to host a site like 8chan's poll board. We've had the same issue getting a neo-Nazi site called Stormfront off. You know, it's been successfully taken down for weeks at a time at some points, but they always find another server. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of similar to the problem that law enforcement has shutting down sites that distribute child pornography. There's always someone somewhere willing to host them. What I will say can be done and absolutely is within the power of American law enforcement to do is to monitor these sites better, is to try to track some of these people down, which they can do, is to be looking at these sites. A young woman was actually browsing 8chan's poll board when the shooter posted the link to his attack and his manifesto a half hour before the shooting began, and was desperately calling and also tweeting to on social media, reaching out to the FBI and calling them on the phone, trying to get someone to do something, and was unable to reach anybody and to get any action taken. In my mind, there should be law enforcement monitoring these places at all times. We know where they are. We know where they're trying to get people to radicalize and announce other attacks. Police should at least be watching them.
Robert Evans is an investigative journalist with the research collective Bellingcat. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
And Hannah Block-Wiebe is assistant professor of law at Drexel University. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you.
One ass whooping, man. There's still one. How you figure that, man? Look around you, man. They own this shit. They own this couch you sitting on. Them shoes you got on your feet. This building. This school. This country, you, we're behind enemy lines, dog. One beat down will never compare to 439 years of captivity. Never. I don't know shit. Freshman.
Boy, I tell you what, when it comes to your kids, you are willing to go to the mat for them no matter what, especially when you believe that an injustice has been done to your son or your daughter. Well, that's exactly the case, a case that's going on in South Fayette High School. It involves the son of a prominent Pittsburgh criminal defense attorney, Blaine Jones. Blaine was with us yesterday. And Blaine, welcome back.
Lynn, thank you for having me. Good morning to you and all of your listeners, of course.
And give me an idea. I mean, I recapped the story a little bit before we actually got you on the air. But in your words, give us the background before we then move forward to what happened yesterday.
Sure, Lynn. And let me just kind of piggyback what you said about it's personal and my child and all that stuff. I want everyone to know out there, and like I told South Fayette, I will not tire and I will not stop until I see changes. I will never stop. With that said, my son, honor roll student, been there for his whole life. He's in ninth grade. He's never been written up for anything, nothing. Very good athlete, et cetera, et cetera. New kid comes to the district this year, and I found out a lot about this new kid and what he's been doing to students of color since this incident. Or not since this incident. He's been doing it before. But it's all the students were too afraid to say anything until now. Now they're telling their parents, and my wife and I have been inundated with phone calls and such, which is awesome. And we encourage more people to step forward. With that said, my son, he was called the N-word in front of all of his peers by this young man. He's called it three times in total, and two of the times the kid said, "What are you going to do about it?" So my son proceeded to engage in a physical confrontation with this man. And of course, we don't condone that. We don't condone it. My wife and I went to the school to pick our son up and figure out what was going on, and the principal led us to believe that we were going to come back tomorrow, which we did the next day, meet with the superintendent, and then we'd figure out what the punishment was going to be. Well, the meeting was still intact, but after I got out of court that afternoon, I got a call from my wife, and she was inconsolable over the phone, and I said, "What's that? What's going on? What's wrong?" And she basically told me they suspended Blaney for 3 days, click, with very little explanation. And that's when I decided my disappointment is something that I need to share and express with everyone. And fortunately, I have the platform to do so. That's when I contacted you all in the media, and you all broadcast the story, and I'm glad about that because in doing so, we were at least 100 to 150 people reached out to my wife and I, and many of them about bullying stories from when they were kids. And more specifically, the African-American population reached out to us in South Fayette with many of the same stories about how their kids are being treated, called slaves, just terrorized. And one little girl, this boy walked up to her, a bigger boy, and yelled the N-word in her face. They went to the South Fayette administration, and the South Fayette administration basically did nothing. I came to find out, I think there are maybe 250, 300 teachers in the district. There's one African-American. And not just teachers, but I mean, if you look at even the staff and everyone, there's none of us. And I'm not saying there has to be, but, you know, there's no outreach being made to recruit, to do anything, to reflect the demographics of the school. Even with Indian and Middle Eastern people, there aren't any. Very little, I should say.
Let me jump in here for just a second, because we this morning heard from some sources within that school district. And, of course, because of confidentiality reasons, they can't really speak directly to the media. But let me tell you some of what they're saying to us. Your son did not respond to any adult. They are suggesting that your son should have gone to an adult and complained about the N-word rather than reacting the way he did.
Right.
And they're saying, while being a racist in their minds is not a crime, attacking another student is.
No, wait. They said being a racist is not a crime. And that's funny because that's pretty much how they operate.
Mm.
And I got to tell you, I have a lot of attorney colleagues, high-powered lawyers who are, in a sense, friends of mine, personal friends for nearly 20 years now. And they know my son and they know my family. And we're getting together and we're trying to figure out what avenue we're going to take when it comes to, you know, if there's a potential lawsuit here. I'm not playing with any of this. And as far as the response from the source, that's a really weak response, and it's really hurtful and it's bothersome, because there's basically a one-size-fits-all approach to determining punishment.
Mm.
So if you're the victim of a bully, and listen, racism's not that bad, but you can't do anything physically. And I don't disagree with that, the part about physically.
Okay. You were being facetious when you said racism isn't that bad. Okay.
Well,
just so we're clear.
Right? Racism isn't a crime.
Right. There's nothing illegal about being a racist.
And I'm glad that source, anonymous source, didn't attach their name to it, because that source probably would be out of a job. So I'm glad they went the coward route and said anonymous source. But, and then I had a meeting with the administrators yesterday. And the reason why I was upset, Lynn, is because we never got a chance to come in and talk about this and look at the other person and their role and what they've been doing to other kids. This one-size-fits-all approach in determining punishment really worries me, because punishment should be specific and not generalized. I thought that you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And, in fact, I thought the way they decided to do the punishment was very lazy, because it's just like, well, this is what it is, this is what you get. It was lazy. And I'm going to do all I can to make sure that this doesn't happen. I'm assembling, like I said, we're getting the group of people together that want to be a part of this, and we're going to notify everyone that we can, and we're going to bring light to a very ugly situation, and it's about that time to do that.
Indeed. So right now your son is out of school on the 3-day suspension. The other student is out of school, I guess, on a 3-day suspension. Are you
3-day? I don't know the days, but that would be something if it's the equal to my son. That would be something. Now, Len, the kid wasn't even at my son's table. He came over to my son's table and started calling my son names. Came over to my son.
Okay.
Specifically. Targeted my son.
So,
I hope to goodness he didn't get the same. But go ahead.
I understand he got a 3-day suspension. I understand, again, going back to this source, that they both got a 3-day suspension.
Wow, the source. Wow.
The source.
Think about that, ladies and gentlemen who are listening. Think about that. Your kid is innocently eating lunch with all of his friends, hanging out, and someone comes over, targets your kid, puts them in front of everyone in a threatening, terrorizing position. Because if you say the N-word to somebody several times and say what you're going to do about it, there's one intent: to terrorize,
right,
to humiliate,
mm-hmm.
to intent. I guess you could say it's twofold. So I get it. But when you're 15 and you're humiliated and you're embarrassed, sometimes you react. All I'm saying is suspension. My son should have served some type of punishment. Shouldn't put your hands on people. But let's really think about this. Maybe a day suspension for someone who's never been in trouble before, with someone who was attacked. But 3 days just because? And then we went and sat down with the administration. There's nothing they could say. They started to use all these generalized, silly terms. And I told them, listen, stop. You can't do that with me. I want specifics. I want to know, go through the rule book with me.
Hey,
levels.
Blaine
there
Jones.
Are four levels.
Blaine Jones. I got to get a traffic report in. You want to stick around?
Absolutely.
Jens, thanks so much for holding on during that break with us. We've been talking about the situation at South Fayette High School. I want to just kind of follow up with you, Blaine, because it sounds to me like you, as a dad whose kids go to this school district, are looking at the bigger issue of how minority students are treated within the district. And if I look at the information coming from our source, it looks like they've kind of focused on this one incident and aren't looking much beyond that.
Well, they can't look beyond that because they know their behavior has been deplorable. And I'm going to show everyone that their behavior has been deplorable when it comes to responding to children that have been mistreated. And listen, generally speaking, the topic is bullying, mm-hmm, okay? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's sometimes in our lives we've all dealt with bullying, and I'm not saying it's going to go away, but I think we as adults owe it to our kids to try to minimize their exposure to bullying, number one. And number two, those that we've entrusted to take care of our kids, i.e. the administrators at South Fayette, once they are on notice of bullying, it is their job to go after it with zero tolerance. They don't do that. They try to sweep it under the rug. They basically play these people off. And I know because I've spoken to them, and I'm not going to let that happen. But the bottom line, Lynn, is that kids need to go to school knowing that they're in a safe environment. These kids are going to school and suffering in silence because they're being terrorized. And the problem is, number one, they know that they're not going to be backed up by the school. And number two, now with my son, they know that if they fight back, they're going to be suspended, and the school, the administrators aren't going to necessarily listen to what they have to say. It's just, this is what the rule book says. This is what you're getting, kid. And like I've always said, practicing law for a very long time, there's the theory and the black letter law, and then guess what? There's the spirit of the law. There's the common sense approach. I can't tell you, maybe 50 police officers that I've worked with have texted me about this. Officers saying, Blaine, your son did the right thing. These are officers who have taken an oath to uphold the law. They've seen the video. They know what he did. But in context, that's what they're saying to me, police officers. And like I said, a lot of my attorney friends, close friends who are very well known throughout Western Pennsylvania and the city, guys I consider high power lawyers, they've contacted me. On my way into work today, I had a good friend of mine contact me and say he was outraged. He's in another state. He was outraged when he saw this. And he said, Blaine, what do I need to do to help you and your family?
And, you know, it's kind of interesting when I think sometimes if you have walked in the shoes of being bullied, if you have walked in the shoes of being the victim of a racist attack on whatever level, whether it's verbal or physical, it changes your perspective on these things. If you've never experienced those things, then it's hard for you to connect.
Exactly. And let me just share a story with you. When we were in there talking to the administrators yesterday, and they tried to give me that general stuff, and I said, guys, I'm not here for that. You got to talk real with me. You got to talk specifics. I said to them, I posed the question, my wife and I, the young man that was suspended, and we all know it was because of racism, racism, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. I said, was he given any type of racial sensitivity classes to complete? Mm-hmm. Lynn, they looked at us like we had seven heads. Why would you not think of that as something that could potentially rehabilitate this young man? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why not? I mean, think about that. That's basic. That's basic 101. So therefore, it brings into question, who are the people leading the school district, or leading, who are the administrators? We need to take a long, hard look at them, and we will be taking a long, hard look at them to see if they can provide a bully-free, safe environment for our kids, because this is the second time since Wednesday they failed the South Fayette community.
Indeed. Blaine Jones, thanks so much. This is a story that will continue. Please keep us in the loop and let us know what's going on.
Lynn, I will not tire and I will not stop. You have a great weekend.
You too.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Affirmative action opponents have filed a referendum to overturn Initiative 1000. Lawmakers passed the initiative to the legislature Sunday night before they adjourned. It would once again allow affirmative action in state employment, contracting, and education. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports.
After Sunday's vote in the House and Senate, I-1000 opponents demonstrated in the Capitol Rotunda. On Monday morning, one of the participants, Khan Chu, filed the paperwork for a voter referendum. Chu is a member of Washington Asians for Equality, a group that argues affirmative action would legalize racial discrimination and penalize, quote, hardworking Asians.
My grandfather, he was trying to get by without job, right?
And now my kid is able to attend Northwestern University.
Chu and his fellow I-1000 opponents have until late July to collect nearly 130,000 signatures to qualify for the November ballot. In a statement, Democratic State Senator Joe Wynn says supporters of I-1000 are seeking opportunity for everyone and are ready to fight, quote, a campaign of misinformation and fear. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
Black high school students in Texas are voicing concerns right now about how an expansion of the state's school marshal program may actually be harmful to them. Right now, lawmakers are considering bills that will expand this program that essentially just puts more guns in Texas schools. Let's break it down. The marshal program trains school personnel whose identities are kept secret from all but a few local officials to act as armed security officers or peace officers in the absence of law enforcement. Advocates for the program say it gives schools the option to implement a last-minute line of defense if there's an active shooter on campus. But gun control activists have decried the program because it puts more guns in Texas schools. And there's more, because in a 43-page school safety plan released days after the Santa Fe High School shooting, Governor Greg Abbott outlined suggestions for changing the program. And just take a look at this. Among the proposals, reducing the required 80 training hours, eliminating a requirement that teachers keep their firearms under lock and key, and increasing the number of marshals that can be appointed per school. And it's understandable kids all over are worried, especially black kids, because, of course, countless studies have proved black students are disproportionately punished in schools compared to their white counterparts. And this includes their sometimes violent interactions with school resource officers. And so here's a quote from a high school student in Texas. His name is Amir Johnson, and he said, you know, we already get profiled based on the clothes we wear, how we look, our hair, what color our eyes are, and the main thing is the color of our skin. Lawmakers can't cover up how these programs might have an unintentional impact on students of color.
So just yesterday, we did the post game. That's the last half hour of the Young Turks. That goes just for our members. But a lot of our members have been great and said, no, you know, we like that you do extra stuff for us, but you should really show this to everyone else. And I think we're going to do that. So an interview with one of our directors, Ja'Cory Palmer, about how he got pulled over and arrested in Santa Monica a couple years back for riding his bicycle at night on a Friday night for nothing at all. It was an unbelievable story. And so we'll put that on shared for all of you guys. And thank you to our members for suggesting that. But if
I just can't believe I don't even know that story. Ja'Cory's one of my best friends here, and I think just the fact that that's not a shocking thing in his life, mm-hmm. like, do you know what I mean? Like someone getting pulled over for not doing something if you don't look like Ja'Cory would be something that you tell everybody, because it is just the worst thing that's ever happened to you, the craziest thing. But that he's one of my best friends here, and I don't even know.
In fact, he talked about that when we were doing the interview. He said, "Look, we get." Like, my parents trained me for this. Mm-hmm. We get trained for how do you react when a police officer wow. comes, because, you know, your life's on the line at that point. And so now I tell you that in this context because now your kids' lives are on the line. Mm-hmm. Because unfortunately, and I wish it weren't the case, but statistically it's proven out in the amount of crime versus the amount of arrests that happen for African Americans versus whites in this country is that there are stereotypes, and it's in a lot of our heads. It doesn't mean like you're a terrible person. It's inbred, unfortunately, into our culture, into our media, etc. And so the African Americans, and especially African American kids, are seen as more of a threat. They are seen as bigger than they are, both in age and size. So cops react usually more aggressively, arrest the black kids more. There's physical harm and violence that happens in those arrests. And now you've got more marshals in those schools. By the way, even if you didn't have the racial issue, and the racial issue is very real and very important, just putting cops into schools makes arrest of students more likely. Mm-hmm. Because if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like nails. What do cops do? They arrest people. Mm-hmm. And if we had cops in our school when I was growing up, they'd arrested half the school. There was fights all the time, and that could have ruined half the school's lives. Now you put those cops into schools where kids are being kids, and you put them more into African American schools, which happens with great regularity all throughout the country, not just in Texas. It's a recipe for disaster.
They're used to punish black kids more than other kids, too. You guys remember, it was a little girl who we later found out her mom had died. She was living in foster mm-hmm. care, but she was sitting in a chair.
South Carolina.
And the teacher was upset because she wouldn't get up and go to the principal's office. So, you need to listen to your teacher, but that was the infraction. She wouldn't get up. Mm-hmm. And that was handled, they called in a police officer to handle a kid not getting up when you told them to. Mm-hmm. That's wild. That's ridiculous. That's not a police officer type of situation.
We talked about that here. I remember when you and I were on that. So here's the thing is that we talk about these things and we talk about symptoms, but we don't talk about like root causes. And I think that there's a whole bunch of stuff going on at the same time. While we're sharing videos that dehumanize black and brown children mm-hmm. on World Star fighting and Sharkeishas and all of that stuff, then it makes it more palatable to be more aggressive with those children because we've demonized them through all of the visuals that we continue to put out. Countless studies, they talk about the FBI studying the infiltration of hate groups within law enforcement, which they say are at a high number now. These hate groups have gone up. They are in law enforcement. They are doing the devil's work. And now you want to minimize training, which is ridiculous, because 80 hours of training alone is not enough to train somebody with firearms around children. And now in addition to that, you want to put some of these race soldiers into the school to police the children, which is going to change the dynamic of the environment of school because all of the children are going to be affected by this. And in addition to that, the black and brown children will be unfairly mistreated. So this stuff is just getting, we were just talking about it. Ja'Cory and I were just talking about how they are normalizing this. Mm-hmm. You know, they're normalizing this stuff. We see it every day. Just the other day, the black boy whose scooter, he parked it outside, walked into the store. The manager said, hey, they're unarmed cops. He came outside. They immediately threw him to the floor, and they started beating him up. It's become normal. And we have to be judicious about our children. And, you know, I just think this is the time for our allies to stand up for us.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends, and I see them interact. They're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
But we begin with breaking news.
I'm going to find you, I'm going to hang you from a tree like an ornament. You attack one of my homies, that's war on me. I'm going to find you and kill you and skin you alive, boy.
In the last hour, we have learned police have arrested the person they say sent racist threats to a black student at San Diego State. Police say that person is Martin Ruiz.
He is a current student who is not enrolled in any classes right now. Police say it didn't take long to identify him, looking at his description in that video and his account handle.
You attack one of my homies, that's war on me. I'm gonna fight you and kill you and skin you alive, boy.
The racist threats sent via Snapchat.
I'm gonna find you, I'm going to hang you from a tree like an ornament.
One after another, popping up from a stranger on CJ Simmons' phone.
He said that he was going to skin me alive and wear my skin as a coat.
He also said that he would hang me by a tree in Love Library.
We first introduced you to Simmons Tuesday when he shared his story. More than videos, the sender snapped this message using the N-word, followed by this. Wednesday, 10 News was back on campus looking for answers.
Things like this need to stop. Like, I shouldn't have to worry about, like, where I walk on campus.
But Simmons and other African-American students still watching their backs.
A lot of my friends have reached out. A lot of people in the community have my back.
Simmons says that since the incident, he's had students, teachers, and other community members contact him offering support. But while police continue to investigate...
And I'm just, like I said, a lot more cautious still. Like, because the more this story gets out, the more he might get mad, the more anything could happen.
Brian Schlonsky, 10 News.
All right, the president of San Diego State issued this statement just within the last hour, quote, freedom from discrimination, harassment, violence are basic fundamental rights, and we refute all instances of intolerance and abusive behaviors. The threats made are fundamentally against who we are as a community. San Diego State says that students are urged to reach out to campus counseling services if they need any help during this time.
College don't mean shit. Y'all niggas. And you gon' be niggas forever, just like us, niggas.
Here's a story that's all new for you tonight at 11. As parents, we want our kids to feel accepted, but unfortunately, that doesn't stop people from being hateful. So we're focusing on a D.C. student who was the target of some racist comments. But there's a twist to this story. His grandfather is well known for leading the fight to change the conversation on race. And Lorenzo Hall talked with him tonight.
Dr. Michael Eric Dyson is a prominent professor known for writing and speaking about racial issues at length. But an incident this week involving his six-year-old grandson really hit home.
Called him the N-word and eventually said, I'm going to go home and get my father's gun and come back and shoot you.
He says a white first grader at Horace Mann Elementary in Northwest made that threat while his grandson was rushing to the front of the pizza line during lunch.
He said, Papa, I'm sad and I'm scared.
Dr. Dyson met with school leaders, the other student, and his parents earlier today.
They were horrified that their son had made these remarks. They couldn't figure out where they had come from because they were socially progressive.
According to the police report, that first grader is accused of threatening another student during lunch as well. It's not clear what consequences he'll face, but a D.C. public school spokesperson says the incident is under investigation.
What about those?
Dr. Dyson says this is about more than his family. He's asking his hundreds of thousands of followers on social media to talk openly about racial issues and bullying to counter the hate kids are seeing these days. We've talked about a few incidents right here. From students wearing blackface to swastikas being displayed during class presentations.
Now we see the rise of white supremacist thinking and a kind of emboldening of those forces. And so we've got to be able to pinpoint those and say this is wrong.
Now, Dr. Dyson says he's now waiting for D.C. public school leaders to come up with a plan to better approach and deal with these issues. He plans to meet with everyone involved in this incident again at a later date. Les?
And we know they'll continue to follow up on this story.
Listen. Just touching on some real issues right here tonight.
That's all.
I want y'all to observe the excellence here. BX providing the sonics, my man, Minnesota. I'm letting the beat ride out because it's a part that I like when it come up, you know what I'm saying? I take this time to say what's up to my family. You hear that? You know what I'm saying?
For sure.
Just observe the excellence of that. That's many.
Then. Hey, back. Fall back.
With the guitars. It's hip-hop music. It's good enough to speak for itself. And you gotta do right by it. Minnesota.
Ain't no black people in Minnesota.
The month-long trial of a former Minneapolis police officer, Mohammed Noor, finished up this week with his conviction on murder and manslaughter charges in the shooting death of Justine Ruzcheck. During the trial, Hennepin County prosecutors revealed missteps by the cops who responded to the fatal shooting and potential failures by the state investigators who were tasked with getting to the bottom of it. But plenty of questions remain. Reporter John Collins has been covering it all, and he's in studio this morning. Good to see you.
Good morning.
All right, so a major theme throughout the trial, John, was the chaos in the hours after Justine Ruzcheck was shot. What did we learn about how officers conducted themselves?
We heard a lot of testimony about that. Prosecutors pressed for one, Minneapolis Police Sergeant Shannon Barnett, who's in charge of the scene, on a number of things. Why did she turn off her body camera while talking to Noor? Why didn't she take what's called a public safety statement from Noor? And at the scene, other officers were captured on body camera footage telling Noor to keep his mouth shut and turning their body cameras off in violation or perhaps in confusion of department policy.
Will there be any fallout, any ramifications for those officers?
Well, Chief Madeira Arredondo has promised that the department will learn from what happened there. And I asked just this week Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey whether any officers had been disciplined. Frey said he can't comment due to ongoing civil suit filed by Ruschek's family. But Frey has brought up that the city has really tightened the body camera policy. Although we haven't heard whether any officers involved in the scene have been coached, disciplined, or terminated.
Okay. So during the trial, BCA agents also came under some fire, some heat with things that came up with the investigation. Do we know whether the BCA has changed any of its policies in relation to what happened?
Well, prosecutors really focused in on a lack of thoroughness on the part of the BCA agents initially. And one instance they brought up, it was about 5 months after Ruschek was shot, BCA investigators had only interviewed two police officers who responded to the scene, and there were many police officers there. Prosecutors also pressed agents on why they didn't follow leads, even when people had contacted them to share information, and how they appeared to be deferential to the police officer they were investigating. And finally, there were also questions about why they didn't more carefully preserve the squad car that Noor shot from. I mean, there has been quite a bit of criticism, and Governor Tim Walz just this week said he's looking into it. We reached out to the agency, the BCA, to talk to Superintendent Drew Evans, and through his spokesperson, Evans declined an interview about the investigation because he said, again, due to the civil suit filed by Ruschek's family. So we don't know whether anything has changed in this agency.
So race was brought up in the trial. The race of the victim and the officer are different than the other high-profile officer shootings that we've seen here in Minnesota. What do we know about how that factored into the trial and then the verdict?
Yeah, we should say Noor is Black, Somali-American, and Muslim, and Ruschek was white and raised in Australia. And critics of County Attorney Mike Freeman argue he would not have prosecuted the case so aggressively if the roles had been reversed. And Freeman has, for his part, denied that race has anything to do with his prosecuting decisions, and he's insisted that he has charged white officers with other crimes in the past. But during the trial, jurors were asked about their experiences with Somali Americans, and race came up again when prosecutor Amy Sweezy implied that Ruschek could not be dangerous by referencing her blonde hair and pink t-shirt at one point. So race did come out at key moments of the trial, but we will never know exactly how it affected this case.
You know, as I was listening to your reporting, I thought it was interesting about the rift between the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, prosecutors, and police. They called a grand jury in this case to compel officers to cooperate, which is a little unusual. Why were officers refusing to talk?
That's another question that we don't know the answer to. Some officers testified at trial that they got advice from the Police Federation, their union, and prosecutors said, you know, about 20 officers had been refusing to cooperate. But a new detail emerged briefly at trial about maybe how this kind of came about. Prosecutors had one police officer on the stand. They were pressing him on the existence of what they called a secret meeting of about 20 officers in the government center's basement cafeteria to talk about not cooperating, they said, with the investigation. The judge ruled that the meeting, which she described as a conspiracy, was not relevant to the case. So we didn't really hear anything more about it at trial. But what's interesting about a criminal trial like this is we hear a lot about what happened, but not about why. And we don't really hear about whether institutions are making the changes to ensure that the same problems don't happen again in the future.
John, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
John Collins is a reporter for NPR News.
Another struggle. My beloved friends, I would be remiss if I did not take this opportunity to mention my dear big brother, Keith Cook. Happy birthday, brother. We gather again another day in another year, another battle, and yes, another battle won. Thanks to you, the people, we, you, and I, have battled in city streets and in rural courtrooms in this struggle for freedom. But how about the struggle for life itself? When I was on death row, facing death warrants with dates to die, you took to the streets of over a dozen cities to say no. Your simple yet powerful no stopped the hand of the executioner and opened the door to life. And when I was sent to another toxic site called a prison, and my health crashed, and I came closer to death than any time I was on death row, you stood in the snow at the gates of the prison, at the parking lot of the hospital, demanding I receive good treatment and care. You, the people, stood with me when I was unconscious in a diabetic coma, and you filled every courtroom available to demand freedom and justice. What a movement this is. We are on the move, for real. And we still are today. What is behind such a movement as this? The answer is as simple as it is profound. Love. I am your brother, and you, all of you, are my family. You are my sisters and my brothers, my aunts and uncles, my people. To thank you, you who've done so much for so long, seems so small, and yet I thank you, all of you. Thank you for radiating so much love over this long struggle. We're not done. We have more to do. We have work to do, yes. But before us also stands justice and freedom. So in all the ways I can, please allow me to say in Kikuyu, Degu, in Somali, Mahatsinet, in Arabic, Shukran, in Swahili, Asante Sana, in Chinese, Xiexie, in Japanese, Arigato Gozaimasu, in French, Merci, in German, Danke, in Spanish, Gracias, and in Ebonics, good looking out, y'all. I thank you all for all you've done and for what we are about to do. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Now, me and Mr. Man just cut Sam Carter out of damn tree. Y'all hear me?
Them dirty, low-down bastards took my boy.
They got my cousin Aaron over in jail and something behind this business. They say it's for his own protection. Now, how that sound?
Yeah. What we need to do, we need to pray. Now, dear Lord...
I ain't no praying move, preacher. Now, what I want to know is right now, what y'all men's prepared to do if and they run back up in here?
Not if, Sylvester. When...
I'm gonna shoot.
At just 23 years old, filmmaker John Singleton captured the America's attention, with his deft and profound artistic vision. His debut film, Boys in the Hood, told an uncommon Hollywood story, the reality of life for teenagers in South Central Los Angeles.
This is Los Angeles, gang capital of the nation.
Either they don't know, don't show, don't care about what's going on in the hood.
With that film, he became the first African-American and the youngest person ever to receive an Oscar nomination for Best Director. John Singleton died earlier this week at the age of 51. And in today's episode of Back Channel, we will retrace his artistic career. Joining me for all of that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Natalie, welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
Mark is the James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He is an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey, Frank. How are you doing?
Natalie, tell us about your relationship with I'm Doing Fine. I didn't answer you. I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. But Natalie, I do want to ask you about your relationship with John Singleton and how you reacted, certainly when you heard about his death.
Well, John Singleton was a very early inspiration for me as a young black filmmaker. We are only 1 year apart. He's 1 year older than I am. And so I was graduating from college when Boys in the Hood came out. And I was going straight to film school. And I just was astonished, actually, at the fact that this young person who had just basically done the same thing that I did, graduated from college, had caught the attention of Hollywood with a script that he wrote in school. But the inspiration for me was that, you know, I can do the same thing. And really he joined Spike Lee in that way of letting me know as a young black person that film is accessible. It's something that I can do. I can actually make movies. And ironically, I ended up going in a different direction and started pursuing documentary filmmaking. But I've always just been really inspired and had a lot of respect for, inspired by and had a lot of respect for John Singleton because of that initial, you know, burst onto the scene and just the way he's been able to sustain his career.
And it was quite a burst, Mark, that debut film, Boys in the Hood, probably his best known work. Remind us of the context of that film and why it was so spectacular and important.
You know, it's the year before the L.A. riots. It's released shortly after Rodney King's beating. You know, gangster rap is some noise that's occurring, you know, on the West Coast that folks aren't really taking very seriously yet as a music or as a culture or something that would impact, you know, American society. His choice to cast Ice Cube, you know, well before Ice Cube was a household name. America's Most Wanted had come out the year before. So hip-hop heads knew him, but, you know, no one thought he had acting chops. The way that he helped create a charter path for Angela Bassett's career, helps reboot Larry Fishburne's career. This 23-year-old directing these seasoned veterans in some sense and these brand-new actors in another sense. It was extraordinary. And it told the story that needed to be told. There was a way in which, you know, and, you know, Spike Lee is not someone I would ever describe as participating in the production of black respectability. But John Singleton was doing something very, very different than what Spike Lee was. Mm-hmm. When we see Menace to Society the year after with the Hughes brothers, by the time we get Spike Lee doing Clockers, you know, in 95, we actually see the way that John Singleton had an impact on the kinds of black film that could be made.
Well, talk about that. What do you mean? You said Spike Lee.
The ghetto cycle, ghetto narrative cycle. I mean, we start to see these films and each film kind of ups the ante, right? You know, Menace to Society is on a whole nother level than Boys in the Hood was, but the impact was clearly there. John Singleton created a space for us to think differently about what kinds of black films could be made.
Let's hear a clip from Boys in the Hood.
As I was saying, he's highly intelligent. He has enormous vocabulary. It's just that...
Yes, go on.
It's just that he has a very bad temper. It makes it extremely difficult for him to interact with the other children. Now, perhaps I could recommend therapy or a child psychologist.
No, thank you. We can manage just fine.
Is there some problem in the home? Are you employed?
That's really none of your business. But since you asked, I am employed and I'm studying to receive my master's degree.
Then you are educated.
Listen, are we going to talk about me or my son?
I'm sorry. Well, we'll be happy to see Trey back in class on Tuesday.
No, I don't think you'll be seeing Trey again.
And why is that, may I ask?
Because Trey is going to live with his father.
His father?
Yes, his father. Or did you think we made babies by ourselves?
Here it is, a clip from Boys in the Hood. Obviously a mother and a teacher, one of the young boys in the film soon after he gets suspended, the 1991 film. Natalie, tell us what about that scene struck you.
Well, first of all, I just love Angela Bassett's, you know, just attitude and determination to set this white school teacher straight about herself, her family, her child, all of that, which is a fairly early representation of that type of black womanhood, you know, that's positive. But I also, you know, as a mom, I guess I kind of I understand some of I understand the dynamics that are present in that scene. You know, just the fact that in a lot of cases in public schools, young black males are not understood. You know, their energy, whatever might be interpreted as anger and all those kinds of things, are often, you know, misinterpreted, misunderstood, and you know, and these types of conversations have to be had. But I also think that, you know, there is something, you know, John Singleton was trying to address. He tries to do a lot, I think, with Boys in the Hood. Some of it works, but some of it doesn't. And one of the things that I think doesn't work, I think that there is, you know, there is this idea that in order for a boy to become a man, he has to go live with a man. And so that is one of the issues that I have with the film, is just this idea that a woman cannot successfully raise a young black male. And, you know, it just kind of harkens back to the Moynihan Report and different ways that black womanhood has been blamed in many ways for black youth going astray. So that scene has some of that in it for me.
Mark, you also wanted to talk about another film of Singleton's, the 1995 film Higher Learning, and there's a particular scene in that you find striking.
It's an amazing film for a couple of reasons. It resonates with me because I was just finishing my PhD program when it came out, and Larry Fishburne's character as a professor in the film, you know, struck a chord for me as I was trying to figure out my own style, you know, in the classroom. But there's this great scene where Omar Epps, as Trey, or Andre, I believe, is sitting on the track and come to terms with what he needs to do. And John Singleton layers that scene with Aretha Franklin's Young, Gifted, and Black. And it struck me as, one, such a wonderful use of Aretha Franklin's music, particularly for the hip-hop generation, right? It was his attempt to make Aretha Franklin meaningful, and that song meaningful for a generation that didn't necessarily grow up with the song the way I might have. And so it struck me that he was really cognizant of how to use music in significant ways. You know, all of his films, you know, if we're talking about Poetic Justice and, of course, Higher Learning and Boys to the Men, he employed, you know, black musical artists, you know, as actors. And even the scene, you know, where Ice Cube and his friends are talking with Omar Epps' character about what he's reading. And he makes a quiet reference to Frederick Douglass. And Ice Cube is like, oh, so you into Frederick Douglass, right? Which Frederick Douglass, right? And you realize, you know, these are guys that are going to be in school for 6 or 7 years for whatever reasons, but they took learning seriously, right? That they created their own space to learn the kind of black history and black narratives that they weren't being taught at school.
And it seems to me that Singleton was in dangerous territory here. There's the Fishburne character giving these lectures to a young Andre, the track star, and sort of lecturing him about, look, if I hear you complain about the white people, if you're a track star, you just run faster, don't you? And they go, ooh, can you give that kind of advice?
Absolutely. I mean, you could then. You can't now.
Yeah. And so, but what about that? The idea that this is dangerous territory that he was treading?
I mean, when you look at the first four films of his career, Boys in the Hood, Higher Learning, Poetic Justice, and of course, Baby Boy, you know, he clearly was tapping into something that mainstream Hollywood film had not dealt with yet. And it put him, I think, outside in a way, you know, at the forefront of something that he was never able to sustain. For lots of reasons, right? You know, because he created folks who come after him that have more resources, right? Who can do more things than he was able to do early in his career.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, May 4, 2019. So I have been told, I have said for some time, a major component of racism, white supremacy, strive for accuracy. Baby Boy, although it is important That is a film that starts reading directly from the ISIS papers. You can check it out. And I think there are lectures where Dr. Welsing talks about her connection to John Singleton and conversations that he had with her about including her work in his films and how she thought that whites in Hollywood would practice racism and disrupt what he was attempting to do. Those lectures do exist. But strive for accuracy. Baby Boy is not one of John Singleton's first four films. His first four films, unless I am mistaken, would be Boys in the Hood, Higher Learning, Poetic Justice, Rosewood. Those would be his first four films, and that is a very important omission. Won't say that they were practicing racism, white supremacy at WUNC, although I suspect that that could be the case. Maybe they did not want to discuss Rosewood and the significance of that film, even though it should be discussed. In my view, that might be his most important film. Talking about the late John Singleton, who passed away this week, might be his most important film, although you could certainly pick racism, white supremacy as a main topic in pretty much all of his work. But I have heard many of his different projects discussed. I think the film that I've heard discussed most this week has been Boys in the Hood. Love those Negro trauma dramas. Boys in the Hood has been the film that I've heard discussed most. I've heard a few mentions of Higher Learning, Hustle and Flow, a few of the other projects, Poetic Justice, a lot of Tupac fans, Janet Jackson, of course, Higher Learning even, but Rosewood, not as much commentary on Rosewood. We will be talking about Rosewood quite a bit as we move through Sundown Town, since that's right on time for our book club. James Lowen, Sundown Town's A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. If you are participating in the book club and you have not seen John Singleton's Rosewood, you should definitely watch the film because I played an interview that he did talking about that movie where he said specifically that he wanted to make sure that he showed black people fighting back. And that's been something that we've been talking about as we have been reading Sundown Towns. There is not very much presentation of black people fighting back in Mr. Lowen's book. There is in Rosewood, 1997. John Singleton, again, he passed away this week at the age of 51. And I will just say again, that is, in my view, a total disgrace and an indictment of the system of white supremacy, 51. Incidentally, I think his family or people who cared about Mr. Singleton, I think they recognized the same thing, because I did see a report. I'll share it during the broadcast, where his family and friends were encouraging black males to do more self-care to make sure they're checking on their heart condition and are in good shape, eating well, that sort of thing. Exact type of things that we talk about on this broadcast, especially since I've been doing all the yoga and such. Self-care, very important. The system of white supremacy puts a tremendous amount of stress and toxins on black people. Managing our health as best we can is extremely important. Another unfortunate reminder. Victim of white supremacy, filmmaker John Singleton, student of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, passed away this week at the age of 51. This is our compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, counter-racist suggestions. The number 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Wow, lots to share. Before we get to the callers, try to be as efficient as possible. I think I announced at least twice. It's only been 2-3 days, but after 17 months of being a flood victim, Gus T. Renegade finally back to the residence. It has been a little wacky. After I got back here, I remembered that I had only been here 5 months. I had just moved and was kind of getting settled in. So I spent 17 months at the temporary flood residence, 5 months at the actual residence that I moved back to. So I got substantially more comfortable there than here, but it has been an adjustment. If nothing else, I have spectacularly enjoyed getting back to my bed. Wow, to have 17 months not sleeping in your own bed. Wow, in my library. That is also, I had almost forgotten. The books, reading is more important than watching television. It even reminded me, being in an environment where I did not have my library, and then coming back and having my library of books around and just being able to turn and reference. I can even give you just one quick example. I was watching Rosewood today. I played the sound clip at the end. Colored folks can't be running all the time. They always loved that scene where he said, we should pray. And Don Cheadle's character said, no praying. It's not time for praying. What are we going to do? Race soldiers are coming. But they have a later scene where a white doctor, racist, comes in to do an autopsy on a black male who has been lynched. And he says, oh, yes, they've castrated him and chopped off his ears, finger. You got to control your niggers. We can't have a sheriff in town if you can't control your niggers. If you can't do it, we'll get someone else to, you know, be sheriff. And so they go out to leave, and he says, put on the death certificate. What was it? He died at mischief at the hands of persons unknown. That's the exact way he said it. And I had such a smile. I turned and looked at my library, and I pulled Philip Dre, At the Hands of Persons Unknown. This is a spectacular book. We will never read it on the book club because it's very, very long. But wow, it is worth the read. So I turned because I was reading this book. I didn't get all the way through it yet. I have read about the first third of it. It's very thick, but this is where I turned to reading that. Recorded lynchings of blacks had decreased in the first few years of the new century from 105 in 1901 to 57 in 1905, but an average of more than one a week, the practice remained an unwelcome fixture of American life. Also of concern were reported acts of vigilantism in Montana, Texas, and other western locales in the 1880s and 1890s that claimed between 150 and 200 lives, and the advent of a new breed of regulators calling themselves whitecaps, who began to appear first in Indiana, then as far east as New Jersey and New York State in the years 1887 to 1900. Unlike the Reconstruction-era whitecappers of Mississippi and the Deep South, who used violence to force blacks off desirable land, whitecaps rode in order to enforce moral codes, punishing wife beaters, adulterers, drunkards, and petty thieves. Influenced by the original Klan, whitecaps wore masks and, like the Klan, disciplined with non-lethal but painful floggings. I don't know about that non-lethal aspect. Continuing, public approval of this trend was so widespread, efforts were made in several communities to legalize whippings as court-ordered punishments. Several advantages of the practice were apparent. The harshness and immediacy of the punishment satisfied people's desire that the repression of crime be firm and unmistakable. The shame attached to the experience would discourage recidivism, and where miscreants could be dealt with summarily, the costs of incarceration would diminish, allowing municipalities to use precious public funds for more worthwhile projects. In dealing with blacks, it was thought by some that a return to routine flogging would render lynching obsolete. Why kill out the race by lynching when subordinacy through fear of the lash will stop it all? A letter to the editor of the Newman Herald, an advertiser, proposed. And I'll stop there. Widespread support of flogging of Negroes will save us the money of incarceration. I'm surprised that idea has not resurfaced in 2019. But yes, reading is more important than watching television. And I think even just the importance of having books around you can motivate reading and thinking about other thoughts as opposed to just nonsense and watching television, playing on your phone, playing video games, screen time. Continuing. Racial dislocation, I can only say 17 months of being dislocated. Wow. I'm so happy that I did at least take advantage with the yoga. What a transformative experience. Would have never thought I would come back a yoga instructor. Speaking of yoga, Labor Day, California Counter Racist Cows 10-year anniversary retreat. If we have folks who are down to hang out in Southern California, Lake Arrowhead, then drop an email, deposit. The first portion would be $375, due at the end of the month. Last portion would be $400, due at the first week of August. Total price would be $775, total price broken up in two payments. But that will cover plant-based meals. Chef Nadira, she was with us in Virginia. No mud. She was with us the whole time in Virginia and made spectacular meals. I think it was pretty unanimous from all the participants. She's agreeable to coming out to California to prepare all of the meals August 29 through September 1. That's Thursday through Sunday, 4 days, 3 nights. We'll have beds, no mud, private lake, morning yoga, evening yoga, counter-racist workshops, lots of time to discuss workplace racism and other aspects of counter-racism. But again, the dates Thursday, August 29th through Sunday, September 1. Initial deposit at the end of the month. Space for 13 people. Hopefully, we did not wait too late. As I said, looking forward to Florida at the end of the year, but just checking to see if we have enough folks for a possible summer rendezvous for a little yoga, counter-racism at the kind of tail end of the summer, August 29 through September 1. Drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com if you are interested. Let's see. Before I even get to the other items, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email and I will get you a physical mailing address. Obviously, new address since I just relocated. So folks, if you had the address I've used for the last 17 months, drop an email and you can get the updated address now that I am back. Again, enormous gratitude to all of the listeners who have invested and kept the cows on the air for a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. In addition to PayPal, you can support via the Amazon wish list. It's on Amazon under Gus T. Renegade. My Amazon wish list is also linked at the blog directly under my PayPal button. Much obliged to all the folks who have nabbed items over the last 10 years. Again, I hope the cows has provided constructive, accurate information about what white supremacy racism is, what it means to be classified as white. Looking at some of the audio segments, a few things to share before I get to some of the callers. The segment where Mr. Jones, the attorney, he's also a parent, he was talking about how his son was called a nigger. His son retaliated and they suspended his black male son. I was so appreciative of him consistently using the term terrorism in that segment to talk about what happened to his son, that his son was terrorized. That's what this is. This is an act of terrorism, and to describe it as such, I thought that was so black, self-respect. Dr. Welsing encouraged that. I encourage that. Use the term terrorism because that is accurate. I also appreciated the fact, apparently an official at the school anonymously to say that being a racist is not a crime. That's the way that whites function all the time. Racism is not a crime. All these other acts. And I mean, even with that logic, okay, somebody going in and calling you a nigger, that's not a crime. Okay. Now imagine, particularly this is something that happens at a school. Imagine if it was, let's say, a 15-year-old black male student goes and decides that he's going to find a white transgender student who also identifies as gay and decides that he's going to call them names. Now you tell me that it's going to be, well, you know, being a homophobe is not a crime. So, you know, it's not a whole lot we can do. Jamal is a handful, but, you know, sticks and stones, that's what they say. So it's not a whole lot we can do with Jamal. Sorry that happened. And yeah, we'll just see if we can have it better start on Monday. Now, if you think that would happen, you can dial in and let us know. I don't have children, but I cannot imagine a planet where that happens. I can imagine, and I feel like I have experienced that, witnessed it consistently. That is what I expect. Racism, being a racist, that's not a crime. Regrettable, reprehensible, but it's not a crime. Nothing we can do about that. Called you a nigger? Mm. Called you a coon? Spear chucker? Mm. Well, we'll pray on it. Next, let's see. The online activity, I think that is important, particularly since they mentioned that Minister Farrakhan was being taken from Facebook. They said they were deeming Minister Farrakhan to be dangerous. I said, wow, really? Based on what? Dangerous to whom? Add that one in there as well. I strongly suspect that all of this attention on monitoring online activity, that that's going to connect to black identity extremists. Same thing that we've been talking about with COINTELPRO operations for black people who are on any social media platform and they are saying anything about racism, white supremacy, especially if you might be saying crack or anything like that or talking about counter violence, it's going to be aimed at black people, non-white people that, oh my goodness, you know, we have got these online terrorists that then the word terrorism will be used. And in fact, that whole section, it reminded me the summer of 2016 when they had the shooting in Dallas. And I remember some individuals were online and they were taking photographs of the alleged shooter, a black male. They were taking photographs of him and putting that up as their profile picture. And I remember some of these people, they were talking and commenting on my page and saying things like, oh, yeah, the alleged shooter, you know, right on. That's my man. You know, that in fact, that was an act of maximum emergency compensatory justice. That's what I remember some people were labeling it as that online, saying, yeah, that's what it was. And right. I support him all the way. Do it, do it, do it. And I just remember saying, like, wow, that is not, I do not think that that's constructive to be saying all of that online. I don't think that's constructive at all. And I could easily see how, as I said, COINTELPRO operations, black identity extremists, them going to link you. And in fact, I remember Professor Griff had quite a bit of difficulty at that time because there was some sort of photograph where they said he had met this guy and, oh, maybe Griff knew something about it. Oh, maybe you were his muse and things like that. I would be very careful about what you post online, how you use your accounts. If you're going to talk about racism, white supremacy, then do it. I would suggest do it in a codified manner. Don't be reckless, because I don't think that all of this attention with regards to online activity, I don't think that that is going to pivot to racists to stop folks like Richard Spencer and the whites who killed Heather Heyer. I don't think that's what it's going to do. I think it's just going to pivot back in the same way that things always do in a system of white supremacy to the niggers. Next, the Young Turks, they had the segment on black black students in Texas who opposed the bill that would arm educators in Texas schools. I felt they tricked me in the segment because I felt there was very little focus on the students' response and their protest and their voice to what they thought was incorrect about this. There was a little bit, but I felt a lot more of it was allowing the Young Turks hosts to, you know, just voice their views, which, you know, I guess they do. But I thought it was significant that they had Aida Rodriguez, I believe is the victim. She's non-white. The victim who was speaking, and she used the term race soldier. I won't say that I was excited, but I thought that that was significant. That is, I can't remember too many times where I have heard one of Mr. Fuller's concepts being used on a pretty large white-dominated media platform. But race soldier, I almost rewound it to play it back. The reason I didn't was because about 5 seconds after she said race soldier, she said, you know that these officers are not going to treat them fairly. And in fact, and then she continued, she said, in fact, in this situation, what we need, it's time for our allies to speak up. And then she went on, I cut it right there because then she went on to talk about white parents and for them to talk about how this is incorrect and what have you. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else will confuse you. But I did note, whoa, she used the term race soldier. Continuing, the report, the black male student at San Diego State University, Dr. John Carlos and Tommy Smith, I believe, were students at San Diego State. I'll go back to, oh, they were at San Jose State. My apologies, San Jose State. Student at San Diego State, freshman, black male, where he reported that he was threatened and this suspected white terrorist said that he was going to skin him alive and wear his skin as a coat. Delectable Negro, homoeroticism, and human consumption in U.S. slave culture. Top 10, Gus T. Renegade. Reading is more important than watching television. He talked about hanging him on the tree next to the library on campus as well. The standard operating procedure, again, I can only say there are so many of these types of threats and different terroristic acts occurring at the university level that there should be, I guess, serious conversations if you are sending your 18-year-old young child off to a predominantly white institution. Really serious conversations about white supremacy, racism, and even remembering what happened to Michael Eric Dyson's grandchild this week. Maybe if you're going to be sending your six-year-old to elementary school, then you need to have serious conversations about racism, white supremacy with them too. I thought that clip was super important because that was a six-year-old who threatened threatened Dr. Dyson's grandchild. Called him a nigger and said he was going to go home and get his, I believe it was father or grandfather's gun and come back and shoot him. Like, wow. White classified as six. What is this? Racist man, racist woman, racist child. 6 years old, not ignorant about racism, white supremacy, not ignorant about what it means to be nigger. I'm still struggling with spelling. Is it one or two peas and apple? I'm still trying to figure it out. Nigger, I got that. All right, next. We on to the next. Let's get to arithmetic. Already got my A in racism. And I'm going to go home and get my father's gun. Is it? It's 6 years old? Is he already out of the gun range? You already assault the violence? Niggers, already got that at 6 years old. If you are white, you cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy. That's why I say every time, anybody, non-white person, white person, where they're asserting, hinting at that the problem or somehow white people are not aware, don't think about, don't talk about racism, white supremacy. Those are the time. And it's so many of those segments. Six-year-old, you're wrong. His parents to come in. That was the other tackiness. He said, Dr. Dyson, he said, he talked with the parents and he said, oh my gosh, I don't know where he got this from. We're progressive, whatever that means. We never tell nigger jokes. I don't know where you're going to get the gun. Whose gun? We voted for Obama 3 times. What are you talking about? Continuing. the black officer, a former officer in Minnesota, Noor, N-O-O-R, I believe is his last name, where he was convicted and all. They had the trial this week, killed a white woman who was an Australian citizen. In that segment, they, number one, they said race, not racism. But in the segment, they said, they talked about the fellow officers, white officers, when they switched off their body cameras after this white woman was killed and told Officer Noor to be quiet. Now, they said, turning off the body cameras, we don't know if this was in violation of department policy or in confusion of department policy. I have never, ever heard anyone given that level of doubt, where maybe what happened is that they didn't know in this type of situation where it seems there might be a fatality, a police shooting. They didn't know. They were a little confused. They were a little ignorant about department procedure and elected to shut off their body cameras. Are you serious? Why is that even suggested as a possibility in this case? It should be automatic. Oh man, you already know how these body cameras got here. Doing that, already up for suspicion that you did something wrong. Charge it. Give me your badge. Give me your gun. You can go sit on what they call it, administrative leave, until we get to the bottom of this, because this looks, what the metaphor, they fishy. Something looks incorrect about this. This is why we got the body cameras to begin with, to prevent this sort of thing, looking like you're doing some race soldiering, maybe some unjust networking too, caller in Florida. Continuing in that segment, they said they were talking about the white woman, deceased white woman, and they said that race came up again because she couldn't have been a threat because of her blonde hair and pink t-shirt. I thought, wow, really emphasizing the paleness, the petiteness, the fragileness, if you will, of this woman classified as white. And I immediately thought, I thought Anders Breivik was blonde. What do you mean? Blonde people can't be terrorists? Blonde people aren't dangerous? The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. John Singleton did the best, most accurate casting job ever, casting Michael Rapaport as the white terrorist who kills Tyra Banks in Higher Learning. I think that is the best casting job ever. I think that is probably the only time any role that Michael Rapaport has had in his career where he didn't have to do any acting at all. He could just come out, get to be a race soldier, and I get to kill a Negro at the end of it. Wow. Let's do it. John Singleton. First few folks who, you could take 5 minutes to share whatever comments, questions, counter-racist offerings that you have. That would be great. If you could keep it to 5 minutes, then make sure that everyone gets at least one chance to share. We should have ample time for you to discuss once everyone's spoken at least once, and then you can add any additional thoughts or questions. This is the compensatory call-in. If we could refrain from using metaphors on this broadcast, I've concluded race soldiers, one of the ways that they practice white terrorism deception, they will use a lot of metaphors, similes, comparisons. And frequently they will insist that two separate concepts are identical, exactly the same. And frequently that is not the case at all. That is just how they practice deception, master deceivers. Victims like myself, we are confused, still learning. We've been exposed to this misconduct for centuries. And then sometimes we just don't have all the information. So we will substitute logic. And instead of using logic, we will substitute and use an analogy or comparison of some sort. And frequently that just produces more confusion. For this broadcast, if we could be explicit, direct with what we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Righto. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, If you have comments, questions to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Gus. I am so happy to hear that you are back in your location at your residence. Congratulations. I want to say that to you. And hopefully you're a little bit more comfortable where you are now at your new home as opposed to where you are. Are you?
I'm still adjusting, but I will have to say, I have so much more space. I was in a very small location. It was supposed to be temporary. So I am a little bit, or I will say substantially more comfortable. The bed alone, let me just stop right there. To be in a really bad, or it wasn't really bad. Let me take that back. It wasn't really bad. I know Cal's listeners who are in far worse beds than I am, but it was not comfortable. So to be back, I had just purchased a brand new bed in the spot where I am now that I had only slept on for like 4.5 months. So to be back with my nice, comfortable bed and my nice, comfortable sheets, that alone has been, I think last night was the first night that I've slept peacefully all the way through the night in weeks. So that alone has been enormous.
Well, that is great. I'm so happy to hear that. Well, I wanted to give you guys an update regarding my situation, my stalker situation. I ended up having another incident last week. If I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to think exactly what day it was on. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was on a Tuesday night. I think it was Tuesday night. Last Tuesday night, the guy that I was talking about and who's been, stalking me at, sitting in the parking lot at the, across the street at the college and, just stalking me. And I had called and you guys suggested I call the police and report it. Well, that last Tuesday, I was in the kitchen again and I was cooking and, I noticed, that it was a car sitting right there, like, it was like he made the obvious that he wanted me to see him. He was parked exactly across the street in front of the window with the lights on, but he was, like, just parked there right in front of the window. So it kind of startled me because when I turned, I had my back turned, so when I turned around and I looked, I saw the car just sitting there. So I had my phone, my camera phone, and I was trying to take the pictures of the car. But I was having issues with the camera. I wasn't able to snap a clear picture before he was left. And as I was trying to take the picture, what happened was my flash went off. That's what happened. He was sitting in the car and he was like kind of slouched down. So I didn't call the cops at that time because I hadn't called at the cops to telling me to try to get some type of picture or the license plate. And I need to say, I know this is probably, I know this is not the best thing that I could have done. I was even thinking about just going like on my porch and just trying to snap a picture there, but I didn't have an opportunity to do that because he pulled off. So what I did, because I didn't have the oral information, I didn't want to just keep calling the cops or what happened without having the proper information. But what I did decide to do, because this guy has been doing this on the campus, which is, the college property, I decided, and, they just had an incident on at UNCG where there was with that shooting. So I know with things like that, they tend to take it a little bit more serious when incidents do occur. So what I decided to do was contact. The next morning, I got up and I contacted the college police department, and I made a report and I told them about the incident and how long this guy has been doing this. And the lady that I reported it to, she said that she would have a police officer give me a call back. I then made a report to the police officer, and she asked me what she could do. She understood my concerns and understood, my safety was at risk, and she asked me what she could do to better assist me in making me feel safer. So I told her, well, you know, what I would like her to do is maybe see if they can get some type of cameras or a security out there. So she was like, well, you know, she said they don't have security cameras there, but what they could do is get a police officer out around that time. So I think it was Thursday night, I did see a police officer out there, but it was a little earlier. But they said they would be surrounding the area during that time. And I also took your suggestion. You were saying that I was looking into trying to buy a camera, surveillance. But what, as I was looking for whatever I was looking for at the Best Buy, at Best Buy and Walmart, I was like kind of searching, and they didn't have what I wanted at Best Buy. But what I ended up doing, because I have some old cell phones, they have this application. It's free, but you can also buy the purchase the premium version, and it's called Alfred. So you can put it on your old cell phones, and you can use your cell phones as a surveillance camera. And it's been working great. You can download, you know, look at it on your computer. You can take, you know, download the pictures and everything. So it's worked out great. I feel pretty satisfied with myself because I been being, proactive, like I said, because I have been minimizing and not taking, feeling as if maybe this wouldn't be taken seriously. But like I said, thanks to the encouragement and the support, from you guys and the callers, I feel pleased that I am taking my safety seriously and not just minimizing and thinking that, nobody's going to listen to me and things like that. So I just wanted to thank you, and the callers for giving me the suggestions that you've been giving me. And it's just, it's just the boldness of these, these racist white supremacists, race soldiers, how they're just so bold and blatant about like wanting you to see that they're watching you and right in front of, right across the street from your house. So, I was just like a little frazzled about that whole situation, but I'm grateful, like I said, for your help. And I did want to talk about something else, but I will see if I have some more time later. And thanks again, guys.
Much obliged. I'm sorry that you're being terrorized, that word correctly used again. I'm sorry that you're being terrorized in this manner, but I am glad to hear that you are, being proactive about your safety and taking that seriously. Contact the enforcement officials every time you pay their salary with your tax dollars. I wish someone had suggested that because, if you have an old cell phone, that absolutely can work to record. And the camera options, too, like I was saying, there are so many of them for anybody out there that's listening. If you're having a similar problem or hopefully if you're not having that problem, but just want to add, security, those cameras, the technology is advancing so much that you can get them there. A lot of the models are really cheap. You can look online even and probably find some other little gadgets, but you can, you would pay substantially less than $100 US and you could get something that would suit your needs and boop, could capture that. You could even, get models that you could have outside, that could maybe capture, like could get this guy's license plate, where you could have better information about his vehicle. So you could boop, print something out, and have that so the police could have more information when you go. But that's just for anybody if you, are looking. Hopefully you don't have to deal with that. But take your safety serious. If nothing else, the news clips that we hear, it's pretty regular every week, incidents of white terrorism. This week it was a lot of children being terrorized. So if this is what can happen to, a 15-year-old, a 6-year-old, then certainly they have no problem, terrorizing an adult Negro. Adult, put that in quotes. Other folks who have a hand up that we've not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Good evening, sir. Go first, sir.
There we go.
That was for me?
Yes, sir.
Hello? Oh, okay. That was okay. Greetings, everyone. Greetings, Gus.
Yes, to the lady caller. I also would encourage her to continue corresponding with the law enforcement in your area. If you're not satisfied with their frequency in surveilling the area for your safety, go down to the station. Request to talk to the person in charge. Because certainly that is what that's what they get paid to do. That's what you pay them to do. And after that, they have the state attorney in that area, that sort of thing. There's all kinds of means that you can utilize to get that done. They should get tired of hearing from you. And therefore, they will take care of that problem. That's for sure, especially if they are getting you to be contacting them on a consistent basis. You have your notation, you have a diary based on the times and the dates and that sort of thing. And eventually, if they're not already going to your satisfaction, they'll end up doing it. As I mentioned before, I have a similar situation, and but it probably doesn't happen as frequent as what I think you're reporting, and so I'm basically telling you some of the same things that I've been doing. I have over the past series of months have been making home improvements, what is called home improvements, and I've been able to utilize non-white people with the task of some of these projects, such as the roof. Right now, I'm working on accordion storm shutters. As some of you will probably know, in this Florida area, hurricane season takes place in a few months, and it's good to be prepared for it. And storm accordion shutters would make it easy to just close the shutters as opposed to having to go get wood and have to fight through the bombardment of people buying up supplies and whatnot to secure their homes. All the retired firefighter would have to do is just to close the shutters. There's some future things that I would have to do also. Lately, I think I've mentioned maybe about a month ago that I was preparing to legal documents, concerning, in case I'm incapacitated or what it's called a living will. There's an attorney that specifies in that particular venue, and I managed to hire a attorney for that non-white black female. In the course of our discourse, communicating with each other, she was asking me, because, people ask the question, how are you doing? And I have a habit of saying, copying from Mr. Fuller, I'm still learning. And from there, it gave me an opportunity anyway to give some insight to this counselor on Mr. Fuller and the global system of race and white supremacy. The attorney was quite interested, she basically was taking notes. I didn't have to pay for it. Lawyers charge you for time, but I wasn't paying. Had to pay her for it. She was taking notes on about Mr. Fuller and Dr. Welsing and the books that the two have to offer for people to be enlightened on the global system of racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works. And I've managed to accomplish that. Last but not least, the DCS program did have a session today, primarily with our daily activities that we normally do on Saturdays. The film of the day was on a documentary on the Black Panther Party, and it wasn't loud enough. So what I would have the young person that was operating the film, I would have them to stop it, and I would kind of like narrate as the documentary went on to give everybody, because we have ages from as young as 7, 8 years old up until something like 16 years old. So you kind of like kind of have to make it fit for those various ages. And I was able to accomplish that and given terms that they write down to come with definitions of the words, that sort of thing. And so everything went pretty well today with the DCS program. And that's my report. And thank you for listening.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Black Panther Party. Wow, documentary. That's constructive use of time and energy. Thomas in New York, much obliged for your patience, sir. Proceed.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, all the callers. Firefighter. Gus, did you get a chance to hear the Amber Geiger 911 case?
No, sir.
Oh, very interesting.
Give us the 911, just for our listeners who maybe missed it, quick update on Amber Geiger, just a brief, you know, who she is and why this is significant.
Oh, absolutely. She shot Mr. I believe his name was Gene Botham, gentleman who was in his own house, and she came home. She was a police officer, got off duty, and went to the wrong apartment and killed this man in cold blood. Then they released the tape this week. After, you know, she just came back from vacation from her, all the money she got from her GoFundMe for killing this man, who was completely innocent. And she was very much more concerned with her job. Oh, I'm going to lose my job behind this. Oh, my gosh, I'm in so much trouble. She's concerned with herself, you know, in the person that she killed. Every now and then you heard her say, hang in there, buddy, hang in there. But everything that she was saying was all about her typical white woman. I thought it was very, very interesting. It was about a two-minute tape, and she was about a minute and 50 seconds. It was all about, you know, how screwed or F she is for killing this man. Welcome home, Gus. And I got your back. I heard that in one of the clips. So I just wanted you to know that. The synagogue shooting seems to make much more news than the white sheriff's son, whom happens to be a neo-Nazi, burning down 3 black churches. I don't remember them giving that nearly as much coverage, especially with the continuing history of black churches being targets of white terrorism. In this country, you would think that it would have been given a lot more attention than it was. Just to keep in mind, 5 black churches burned in 1 week in 2015 happened to be the same week that Mr. Dylan Roof went and killed the non-practitioners at Mother Emanuel Church. So continuing history of terrorism against black churches being overlooked by white media. Police and schools. New York City Police Department School Safety Division is in charge of the schools here. All of the New York City school safety officers are trained by the NYPD. I don't think they have to go through the whole training of an officer, but they are you know, they do have to do training and everything with them. So they have 5,147 of these officers in the schools and 270 armed police officers who are ahead of the, you know, special task force they have in the school. Metal detectors on the doors, so everyone inside the school is just armed, very prison-like. Anytime you put police officers around black people, in my opinion, that's white terrorism, based off of the history we've had with law enforcement in this country. And it seems to be continuing in the same way. The guy whose son was suspended for 3 days for fighting, did you say he was only 6 or 7 years old, Gus?
Now, see, there's so many incidents of terrorism. That young male, he, I believe, was like 15. It was the 6-year-old was Dr. Dyson's grandchild. But the 15-year-old, he was the one that got suspended for fighting after he was called a nigger.
Yeah. And that situation is terrible that you get punished for being the victim. However, could have been expelled. You know, that's a tough one because, you know, your code is to defend yourself. But, you know, if you allow a white person to just outright call you negative, the next time they'll be spitting in your face and you have to, you know, so it the system has to stop. They said it was a meeting with 20 officers and they decided they were not going to cooperate with prosecutors. That is, by definition, criminal conspiracy, and depending on the prosecutor, could qualify under RICO laws, Racketeering, Influence, and Corrupt Organizations Act. Anyone who knew about the meeting would be indicted as well if they followed the law, but white supremacy, they have selected prosecution. They select and choose who they're going to prosecute and when they're going to prosecute. So then some people don't get prosecuted at all. A municipal officer violating their oath, they could be charged under state law with breaking an affirmation. You know, it's so many ways that they broke the law. Lastly, John Singleton, I think he did very satisfactory work in his art of filmmaking. He was as good as a black director could and a system of white supremacy. I think that he pointed out white supremacy in a lot of his work. And they mentioned Spike Lee. I think Mr. Lee, he deals more with anti-blackness in his best work. But Spike John points out the problem much more accurately. I personally think Higher Learning was his most, you know, his best movie. I mean, I just like that movie. It's not that I liked the movie, but I just thought it was very accurate. And you were absolutely right. Mr. Rappaport was the perfect character to play himself in the movie. Sort of like when you watch DMX in a movie, just being DMX, you know, he was just being a white supremacist. That's what he does. I believe he also called Spike Lee some names that I won't repeat on the show, other than nigga. That movie by itself, to me, Boys in the Hood, it introduced L.A. black gangster lifestyle and mannerisms to the psyche of young people all around the country. And it did a much more successful job than any music that predated it. It was the visual effect. I remember it, I always liked the West Coast music. And me and a few of my friends, you know, we would purchase the music and we would play it outside, and most people said, man, that is fake. You know, man, them dudes is fake, man. You know, they, you know, until that movie came out, it was like, wow. You know, and that culture kind of spread throughout the country as a result of that. But I thought he did a great job pointing, I mean, that movie, it being that they've spoken about it so much, I mean, it had constructive points in it where he was effectively raising his black son, and there was a black family of effectively raising their black daughter. You had a young black couple trying to raise a black child, you know, under those conditions, you know, showing teen black pregnancy. And, you know, in an area where you have gunfire and helicopters, you know, it was pretty accurate to show the type of terrorism they were under in Los Angeles, which we couldn't believe in the New York area. We were like, oh my God, you know, we don't have helicopters and, you know, things like that flying over us. So I think he did a very good job. And Gus, I'll meet my line.
Much obliged. Like DMX playing himself, that would be a simile type of metaphor. Interesting, too, in comparing Michael Rapaport to the character he played in Higher Learning. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, counter-racist suggestions, let me give out the number one more time, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. And they accuse niggers. They had a front page article in the Seattle Times saying that non-white people, black people specifically here in Seattle, are disproportionately charged with obstruction of justice. And it can be for anything. Mouthing off, as they say, being disrespectful, a lot of discretion, a word I'm mindful of. Those officers in Minnesota forming a conspiracy to not cooperate, that seems like, at minimum, maybe that's obstruction of justice. In a murder case, no less. Like, maybe that's obstruction. I'm talking foolish, I reckon. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, proceed.
Hello.
Can I be heard?
Let's get our female caller first. Irie in Louisiana. Did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yes. Hi. Good evening, everybody. And good evening, Gus. So you were talking about people posting online in regard to, you know, not being codified and things that they applaud. And then I thought I heard something about anti-Semitism in lieu of that. So I wanted to say that the country of Israel runs a lot of life activities in the United States, including economics, politics, law, and war. And we can also insert, data collection and monitoring, otherwise known as surveillance. They do a lot of that for the CIA, FBI. So, yes, indeed, you are being monitored. Everything is being collected, archived. There's a book, Nowhere to Hide, by Glenn Greenwald. I've read it, and, they're saving everything. I'm confused about how it is people who classify themselves as white allow white people who classify themselves as non-white, how they get to maintain so much authority. That's confounding to me. Amber Geiger, I have a friend that lives in McKinney, Texas, and she told me that Amber Geiger actually radioed in for EMS before she called 911, and I don't know if that was before or after she was caught yelling and walking up and down the apartment complex by the non-white female that caught it on her videotape. And I'm not saying this is absolute truth, but she's closer to the situation, this person I know, than most of us, I guess, or the people that have spoken up are. And I'm inclined to believe that that's probably what she did, practicing deceit by calling in and saying, oh my God, I'm sorry, that is my house. And there's, you know, so there's that. To Draftomania, I applaud you making the paper trail and the reports. I would implore to you to invest in some type of indoor security as well, because this gentleman sounds like he could be capable of escalating and trying to, I don't know what your perimeter is like, but I just feel like he could try to level up. Well, that's a metaphor. He could try to escalate in his terroristic activity. I would invest in some inside surveillance. I would also set up items to know if they've been moved upon reentry of my dwelling. And it may get to a point that you would like to, I don't know, dog sit or invest in a dog because, you know, that is very peculiar, but it's good that you're pursuing due diligence. I disagree with the non-white lady that said you don't need a man to raise a black male into a man. You know, so VGQ to that, as a single mother, I say you still are going to need a periphery of black men around some kind of way. I just don't agree with it. And that's all. That's just, to me, the natural way that manhood is derived. You mimic, every human being mimics what they see when it comes to what they eventually become in a way. I saw my mother. I mimicked her in a lot of ways, her femininity. I don't see how that would be different for a black male child. In regard to Eric Dyson's son or grandson, so many, many years ago when we were dislocated after the storm and in Great Lakes, my son had a white male friend, and they were both around 4 or 5 years old. I was thoroughly confused, still learning, though. And the mother and I were pretty cordial to each other. She was like, oh, my son loves, you know, your son. Can he spend the night? I said, yes. So that happened, and there was no hitch. I spent time with her, so I thought I knew them, you know, adequately. So later on, maybe a couple weeks later, there was a 4th of July thing on the base, and she was like, would you like to come with us? I said, sure. So went on the base with her, her son, my son, myself, and in the middle of, like, just out of totally unexpected, her son proceeds to draw back with all his might and gut punch my son. And then my son just, you know, he barreled over in complete pain, and tears immediately started coming out of his eyes. And the first thing she said was, oh my God, why would you do that? I have no idea where he would get that from. What's wrong? Why? And I was stunned, and my first reaction, and I'm not being metaphorical, I wanted to hit him with his mom with him. I wanted to pick him up and throw him against his mom. But then I remembered, I'm on a base, a Navy base. It's 4th of July, and I understood at least then I cannot attack a white woman and her child on a Navy base on 4th of July. So the only thing I could do was egress out of the situation. And I said, you know what? I think I'm just going to go home. We're just going to leave. And that was the end of that relationship. So that young man, I knew right away, if she didn't know where he was getting it from, well, she's probably lying, but his dad is doing it. Just like that young man that did that to Professor Dyson's grandson. If it's not the dad, it's the granddad, or it's the circle of men. So going back to the non-white female talking about you don't have to raise a man to, you know, men don't have to raise men, this is more evidence that, yes, indeed, they do. They do. White men teach white boys how to become race soldiers or white supremacists. And the last thing I wanted to share on, I can't pronounce his name correctly, Imhan Dicey. He is very much correct with the information he gives on the piddling with the sunlight. I have developed a skin condition where I have to take extra vitamin D or my skin will start to dissolve on itself. The first, like the top three layers of epidermis will painfully come apart. And I went to doctors about it and was misdiagnosed by a non-white so-called Indian doctor who tried to tell me it was eczema. I said, no, sir, it's not. I know my body. I've been in it all my life. I believe it's this, which is what is called pityriasis rosea. So I asked him for an order to get UV treatment, which he refused to give me. So I had to go and pay money to tan. And I learned about what the condition was, and it requires extra vitamin D, extra collagen, extra lysine, and extra vitamin C. And this is stuff that you get from either sunlight or fruits and vegetables that obviously have a lot of nutritional value because of the sunlight that they hold. You know, that's basically the product of what a fruit is. It's the product of a tree getting energy from the sun. And it was severely lacking. And yes, he's right. We've got to pay attention to this. I'm in the South, so I shouldn't have to worry about going to go tan. And the update on my other situation with my son, I shared on it yesterday, I believe. I have a meeting with the teacher, and I'm developing a series of questions for her and her boss to the whole thing. Everybody's been alerted. The school board of education has been alerted as well. And I went to a school board meeting and basically let everyone know publicly in so many words without saying names that there was a case of sexual harassment at the, you know, the prerogative of a teacher. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus, and thank you, everyone else.
Much obliged.
Thank you, ma'am, on your report.
Echo.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello? Oh, how you doing, Gus? Hold on, somebody else?
Proceed.
I'll go after the other guy.
Proceed. You already started, sir. Proceed.
Oh, okay. All right. Gus, I just wanted to make a suggestion because you mentioned PayPal. And for any other new listeners or call, again, this is Victim out of New Jersey. People are moving from PayPal onto Cash App. So that's something you might want to look into. Female caller who has a potential white stalker. I don't know if she is a homeowner. But sensor lights would be a good suggestion to put on her home. My grandmother and my uncle just invested in a doorbell that has a camera. So when the doorbell is pushed, it can be viewed through their cell phone who's at their front door. Mohammed Noor is the police officer who has been convicted. At the time that he's facing time, you have acquitted Oklahoma race soldier Betty Shelby. She is now a NRA gun instructor. Nellie Fuller said this many times. They don't get fired. They get promoted. Young race soldiers in school. Two incidents. Cousin of mine had a white suspected race soldier in training make a statement, not directed at him, but in his vicinity. And he says that black people are trash. My cousin's son was very angered. I don't know the particulars, but his son did go to white teacher, suspected race soldier. He basically told my cousin's son, he's from a white neighborhood. He doesn't know any better. Don't worry about it. So now I go back to the clip where the father suggested after the incident like this, some kind of racial sensitivity training, something. So that just brought me into remembrance of that story. My cousin followed up and went to the school, and he wasn't able to talk to the teacher, but he talked to the principal. And he talked to another non-white female teacher who he's been in contact with before, and they have a good relationship, and he informed her, and she too was disturbed. I don't have any updates on how that situation went. Another female friend of mine, she's in a tragic arrangement, and she moved from a predominantly black area to a white area with her white husband. Her son started, you know, went to a new school, predominantly white, and he was being called nigger and was being harassed. I asked what was she doing to solve this problem. Immediately, I asked, what is the white husband doing to solve this problem? She said nothing. I don't really have any updates on that. And you also said that young little race soldiers in training, they know what's going on even at the age of six. I recall a story when I was at work, and there was a young white kid on the playground, you know, stuck his head over the gate. He says, wow, what a crappy job you have. You know, I look, you know, and I just proceed to work. By the way, you know, I'm a truck driver. So, you know, these children, these white children are not naive. They are fully aware, and they're learning this behavior through the education system, through television, and at home. All right, and I'm going to close with another story about another child. I had a little cousin, black female, on a bus, and she was getting teased by another black male. There, my cousin is around the age of 8 or 9, and the white young boy came to her defense, and he says to the black young boy, he says, "You're not going to do nothing to me. I'm white." So they're not naive. They know exactly their position on the planet. With that, I'll mute my line.
White people can show you better than I can tell you. The words of Neely Fuller Jr. There was Yes, sir. Mr. Steele, much obliged. Thank you for your patience, sir.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I just wanted to start out this report by saying I'm calling in from Los Angeles, California. And rest in power to John Singleton. I recall, I think 2 weeks ago, he was admitted into a hospital a stroke. That's what the initial report indicated. In fact, I think that occurred during a broadcast of the cows. That's when I got the alert from, I believe it was from CNN, that I got the email about that. But it was said that his family wanted to let people know to monitor your blood pressure in the wake of his death. And I just wanted to report that, blood pressure is a serious issue that can be taken care of a number of different ways. One of the ways that you can tell that you have high blood pressure if you're a guy is if you're experiencing any sort of symptoms like ED. That's like one of the first symptoms that you can pinpoint, because, you know, the symptoms of high blood pressure are kind of elusive, but if you're having trouble, in that area of activity, that is a good indicator that you could possibly have a high blood pressure issue. Also, if you look at yourself in the mirror and if you have this kind of glossy, I don't know how to explain it, this kind of glassy, glossy look in your eye, I can just look at people and I can see it. If I'm experiencing high blood pressure, I can see it in myself. So if you look into your eyes and they seem kind of like glazed over a little bit or kind of glossy, that's an indicator that you could have high blood pressure issues. And ways of fixing your high blood pressure naturally is you can incorporate beets into your diet. You can also incorporate celery into your diet and dark carry. These three foods definitely lower blood pressure very quickly, actually. You can lower it as much as 30 points by if you're experiencing like a hyper, you know, a really high blood pressure, you can lower it tremendously by consuming these foods. Or you can consume extracts of these foods. That's something that I consume regularly to kind of keep my blood pressure in check. And, you know, just staying away from excessive sodium is another way to maintain a lower blood pressure. And finally, cardio. Incorporating cardio, that's like, it's not fun, but if you can find some way to incorporate cardio into your weekly routine, that is an activity that can definitely lower blood pressure. Also, real quick, easy way to, you know, get some money out of Amazon. If you're ever dissatisfied with any sort of transaction that went down on Amazon, if they're late delivering a package, you can go ahead and call and complain. Earlier today, I had some lights that were supposed to be here for a project that I'm shooting tomorrow, and I, you know, they said that the lights were going to be delayed possibly till Monday, so I immediately called Amazon, and I requested that they rectify this with some sort of compensation. And the first person that I got offered me $5. I refused, and I asked for their manager. The next person offered me $10. I refused. They sent me to their manager. Now, these first two people were in India, and then finally they sent me somebody that was on, I think it was called the customer success team. And this lady was clearly in the United States, had a southern accent, and was very nasty and sarcastic on the phone. So, you know, after some discussion with this person, she hung up on me. And I called right back, and lo and behold, when I called back, the first representative offered me $30. And then I asked for their manager, and then I got offered $40 for my inconvenience, at which point I was kind of pressing my luck. I ceased complaining, but I also requested to get the information of the manager that was treating me very rudely. I got some information about who they were, and I was told that I would be emailed an email where I could register a complaint. And finally, they gave me the email of Jeff Bezos, and it was simply just jeff@amazon.com. So I don't know how effective sending an email to that would be. But what I will, I am planning on doing is complaining about this person, and I'm going to go ahead and CC leadership that is attached to this person via LinkedIn. So I'm going to go ahead and use LinkedIn in an attempt to find any sort of leadership that is more accessible, and then I'm going to go ahead and CC all of these people to make sure that my complaint about this call is registered and my inconvenience is remedied. And then finally, Facebook and Instagram are banning profiles that they deem dangerous. You know, they targeted a slew of white supremacists, and they made sure to include Minister Louis Farrakhan, people that they went ahead and banned. The goal is basically to kind of squelch any sort of opinions that, you know, they deem as problematic. And this goes along with their announced strategy of removing likes from Instagram. I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to remove any sort of indicators of, you know, some of these people that can use like likes as social proof of their ideas or, a way of gaming their algorithms to be shown to more people. So they're going to go ahead and remove likes, and then they're banning profiles. And this goes hand-in-hand with them adding more scripted programming to both services. They have what they call IGTV, and then they have Facebook TV, whereby they're pushing content that they've approved of, that they have made, as opposed to content that is user-generated and that is supported by organic growth just by word of mouth or
30 seconds,
by interest. So I'm just saying that, be aware of what these services are doing with some of the with some of the profiles that we frequent. Any one of us could be targeted next. I'm going to go ahead and mute my line. Thank you so much.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. I think pressing my luck might be a metaphor too. Other folks who dialed in with questions, suggestions, comments, proceed. Are there folks that we missed totally that have not shared?
Greetings, Gus. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Nice to hear you're back at the current residence. I hope you enjoy until the last. reason I'm calling is to share information from a book that I'm currently reading called They Were Her Property, White Women as Slave Owners in the American South by Stephanie E. Jones Rogers. She's a non-white black female. I first heard this book suggestion through the context of white supremacy by a non-white black female between, November 2018 to December 2018. I can't quite remember. But I'm starting from the fifth page of the introduction section and carries to the sixth page of the introduction section. Abigail Adams, the second First Lady of the United States, advised her son, John Quincy, to postpone marriage until he had accumulated enough property to ensure that he would not be wholly dependent upon the wealth his future wife might bring into their household. When John Quincy hinted at the possibility that he might indeed marry for money, Abigail firmly advised him never to, quote, form connections, unquote, until he saw, quote, a prospect of supporting a family, unquote. In his response, John Quincy assured his mother that he would never be, quote, indebted to his wife for his property, unquote. In the South, slave-owning women possess the kind of wealth that prospective suitors and planters in training hope to acquire or have at their disposal. Why else would John Moore crassly tell his cousins Mary and Richard that, quote, girls bait their hooks with niggers and the more they can stick on, the better success, unquote, they would have in securing a worthy husband. According to John Moore, even young women outside the ranks of the most elite slaveholders, who typically own 20 or more slaves, could increase their chances of marrying well if they owned a few. He told his cousins that, quote, the girl that has but one or two will get a few nibbles and occasionally catch a trout, but not until he has tried and failed at the larger hooks, unquote. As this correspondent suggests, some men entered their marriages with little or no wealth, and their unions with propertied women became their primary avenue to financial independence. My personal thoughts and questions after reading that passage were, white men the original financial predators? My definition to financial predator: one, a person who lies to scam people out of money. Two, a male or female who uses a relationship or marriage to deceive their partner in order to gain land, money, property, or networking connections without revealing their true intentions to their partner. Makes me wonder, when they saw single white women, were they like, she might be unattractive in the face, but she owns a few niggers, so I'll ask her hand in marriage and get wealthy from her niggers' slave labor. I'll pause right there. If I get a second chance, I'd like to read another quotation and share my thoughts. Thank you.
Wow. Reading is more important than watching television. And I have that book. Hopefully we can get Miss Jones Rogers as a guest on the program. But wow, baiting the hook with niggers. What a metaphor. We'll pause. Maybe we'll have another snippet of reading as we proceed. Folks that we have not heard from at all, *61 if you have comments or questions. Are there folks that we've missed completely? Let's see. Well, give me one second. Let me double check to make sure. I heard you, Ivy. Actually, Ivy, you have not shared yet. Proceed.
Okay, then, Justin, then, so I'm going to call it on mine. The race soldier in the grocery store last time who publicly mocked me, and I asked her if she does that to everyone or just those classified as black. Well, she terrorized me today. As soon as I went in there, I don't know what those things are. Whatever those things are, they're really big. And the employees, they drive them to stock things. Well, she tried to hit me with that. And she said, I'm just driving crazy today. I didn't say anything to her. My back was turned. I saw that the, whatever that thing is, it was like a good distance away from me, but it was on the same side as I was. Like, so I was, I guess, on one side of the aisle. She was on the other side of the aisle. But whatever that thing was that she tried to hit me with was on the same side as I was, but it was still like way in front of me. It was a good distance from me. So she got on there and drove it straight toward me, as opposed to driving it away from me through the aisle so she could get where she was going. And she got extremely close to me. It seemed like within an inch. And she was instantly very close to me. So she said what she said, and then, you know, I didn't say anything. And what I did is I immediately went to, or after a couple of seconds, after a few seconds, I went to one of the cashiers and I asked him if the manager was there today. And he told me that she was, and he asked me if I needed her. He went to get her. Oh, he buzzed to get her through, or he spoke through some walkie-talkie or something to get her. And when she came up there to the front of the where the cashier and I were, I asked her, I said, could you come with me for a second? And she did, and she followed me, and I took her over to where the race soldier was. And I told her that I'm being harassed by her, and I pointed to the race soldier. And I said, what is the remedy to this? And I said that previously what she did was that she, you know, she mocked me publicly, and she was imitating something that I was doing. I was securing my earrings, the backs of my earrings, and she was imitating that and laughing at me and telling her coworker this. And I said, and today, right now, she just tried to hit me with that thing, because I don't know what that thing is called. And the lady asked me, she was a non-white lady. I don't know what her racial classification was, but she's a non-white. And she asked me, when did it happen in terms of the mocking? And I told her 2 months ago. It was in March 7th. I didn't know the date at the time, but and she said that she and the race soldier, as I was explaining, and I also told her, I said, you know, I just want to come in here and go shopping and leave. I just want to come and shop and leave. I don't need her. I don't need to have any type of anything with her. I don't even know her. I'm trying to, you know, what is the remedy? And I'm not sure if I said this already, but she asked me exactly what happened in terms of the mocking, and I told her, I described it to her. And so eventually she told me that she asked me for my name and number, and I gave her my first name, and I gave her a number that she could reach me at, but it wasn't like my personal number, but it was a number she could reach me at. And she said that someone, I don't know, she said she'd be talking to a manager or someone above her or something, and I'm almost done, and that, you know, they would call me. I'm not sure if I should have done that, because I don't know that I want to give out any of my information, including my name. It's like, just get this resolved. I don't need no one calling me or anything else. Y'all need to just talk to her and have her to just leave me alone and let me go in there and shop and leave. I don't really need anything else at all. But I did what they wanted me to do, and I'm wondering really whether or not I should go in there anymore, given the fact that, because I didn't realize until I got home, you know, that this was a terrorist attack and this was a violent act, and that even if she was just trying to threaten me or scare me, she still could have hit me. And that goes back to when the race soldier tried to hit the Codify software developer with his car. Like, even if he was just trying to threaten her or scare her, he still could have hit her. But that's what happens when you use weapons against people. It's just like if you shoot a gun in the air, it's like you may be just trying to scare them or intimidate them or whatever, but the bullet is going to come down and hit someone, and it can hit the person that you were trying to scare. And so that's all I have for now, but I wanted to share some other stuff, but I'll just leave it there for now, and I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Thank you so much for sharing, Ivy. I'm sorry that happened to you. I'll say it later. I was going to ask maybe a different grocery store, but I'll ask later. Folks that we have missed completely.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. A lot of interesting clips. And I think everyone is sharing, and I hope they can receive the remedies that they're seeking. Always remember to write things down. It's always good to tell people, but especially companies, they seem to respond to paper trails. So even if it's just a social media post or something, writing is very important. But I wanted to talk specifically about, I believe, the incident in North Carolina where the young black man was verbally terrorized by the white student, which could have led to violence. I appreciate the father being there for his son. That's important, and that's wonderful. In addition, I would appreciate it, and maybe he did on another platform, talking about the legalities of this, because in North Carolina they do have stand your ground laws, and if someone comes to you and calls you a nigger and asks you what are you going to do, this and the other, I mean, I will feel personally threatened, and I will feel like I will have a right to defend myself. And, you know, and it says relief from criminal or civil liability. I believe being suspended is a civil liability. You are preventing me to do something. Not only that, I have a right to do. You have legally obligated me at the age of 15, obligated my parents to send me to school. This is something you have mandated by the state. And because someone has threatened me and I have chosen to defend myself, you know, based on your law, now I cannot get the education that you have told me that I'm required to get from you. So I don't know if he's going to talk. He talked about that to other people, and I think it's important for us, no matter what state we live in, I have to look it up in Georgia, but to know these stand your ground laws, and sometimes you may have to be the one to follow through with charges, or you may be charged, and I hope this doesn't happen. But in this case, the son, I believe his civil liability, his civil rights, I guess, were violated, and that hopefully the father will pursue that legally. The law says, and I looked it up, that a person is justified using force, except deadly force, and this person didn't do that against another, when and to the extent that the person reasonably believes that the conduct is necessary to defend himself or herself or other or another against the other's imminent use of a loose, unlawful force, and it goes on. You can't go against a bail bondsman or law enforcement. But this student, this other student, this white student, was not in law enforcement. Yes, he had a right to be at the school, but he didn't have the right to specifically go over to this black student to start terrorizing him. So those are things we need to look up, make sure we know those laws, and be prepared to fight knowing these laws. Thank you.
Much obliged. Definitely learning local laws, extremely important. Value your life. Other folks who dialed in that we missed completely, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings. I wanted to give a food update, I guess, since I'm cooking, and I'm cooking something healthy. Yeah, so that's kind of cool. I'm eating jackfruit. It's like preserved jackfruit, I think, and tortilla chips. No. Yes. So, well, it's jackfruit and wheat tortilla, and then guacamole, or I got some avocado and blended it in my blender. I went ahead and bought a new blender since my other one got misplaced or something. I can't think of what happened to it, but I'm so happy I got another blender because now I can eat a lot of my fruits and vegetables that I like to eat. So there's an update there. I wanted to mention, I'm sorry, I had missed the lady's name who made reference to what I was saying about the chemtrails and making, and I wanted to say, I'm sorry to hear that you're having health problems due to the sun being blocked out. That's very unfortunate. And what I would say is maybe you could go to the beach for a little bit. It's kind of expensive, and maybe, you know, if you have to get a hotel, I don't know if you know people near beaches where you could stay, but if you could go to a beach and get some of that sun, it's more difficult to block out the sun close to the water because the wind is constantly blowing. That's really most of what's needed for these clouds to move out of the way. It's the wind to blow it away. It's kind of simple. Well, it's not that simple. It's simple, though, somewhat. But anyway, I would say go to the beach and you can get a lot of sun. I went to the beach with my family just last week, and we went to Florida, and it was very nice. They were spraying chemtrails, even over the ocean, and they were spraying chemtrails all over. And I was taking video footage of it, and, you know, I'm on the beach taking video footage, white people all around me. I'm out in Jacksonville. white people all around. Only white people on the beach. Brown white people. That was, I don't know if it was hilarious, but it was very, very odd. Brown white people. Oddest thing. And, you know, just a few of them that really, really wanted to tan. And then I seen a couple of them that would be at the beach, but they're under, like they're real, real pale and they're under an umbrella. But anyway, you should go to the beach and get some of that sun. White people are getting that sun and they are taking that beach and won't allow black people on the beach. And while I was on the beach recording the chemtrails, you know, and enjoying the water, but if the chemtrails are there, I'm going to press record. And then they had this two helicopters, the two Coast Guard helicopters that looked like military helicopters flying over. But it was really just flying over my family. And then I started videotaping them. You know, they're just flying over. They're getting in my way, getting in the way of me filming these chemtrails. So, you know, they get in the shot too, in the video shot. And then so they sprayed some gas on us. And so, like, the wind was blowing in a diagonal direction, and they flew over right to where the wind would blow the gas right to us. They let out a puff of white smoke because they had been looking at me, but like they're like leaning out of their helicopter type of looking at me, not fully leaning out, but like I can see your eyes, you know. And anyway, they let out this white smoke in a perfect position where they knew the wind would blow it to us. They know the rate of drop or whatever. They know everything, all the math, you know. And so it was just this gas smell. They did the smoke, and then, 10 seconds later, gas smell all over. My mom's choking. My people are like, oh, what's that? And I was, you know, I had pointed out, did you see them do that gas? So I left, you know, or I walked away so I didn't choke or get whatever type of poison they were spraying. And some of the people on the beach, these white folk, were complaining about the gas smell. Like, obviously, this isn't something that they do often, you know, go around spraying the people on the beach with the gas at a very low altitude so that they can smell it immediately. This isn't something they do regularly. Anyway, I leave for a while, you know, just sit in my car. And then the helicopters leave. And then so now I can go back to the beach since they, you know, they left. But long story, go to the beach and you may be able to get some sunlight. And help yourself. So, and we have to end white supremacy. Oh, white people are talking about these chemtrails, and they're talking about it in creative ways in their movies, all these big blockbuster movies. And I'm not going to say much more on that, but they're talking about it, and they're talking about it in a lot of publications. And they just act like they don't really understand what's going on, or they won't give you the full information. So, thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Sorry, your terrorism again. Terrorism again. Sorry you all had to experience that. We are almost out of time. Are there folks that anybody that we missed totally that has a hand up that we've not heard from? Do we nab everybody? Anybody that we missed who has hand up. I'll assume we got everybody or folks are satisfied. The caller who wanted to give us one more section of literature, if you are still interested, proceed.
Still in a, can I be heard clearly?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Okay, they were her property. White women are slave owners in the American South. Okay, this section I'm starting from mid-page of page 7 in the introduction section. In this book, I employ the term mistress in a radically different way, one that aligns more closely with its original meaning. The Western Europe, a mistress was, quote, a woman who governed correlative to a subject or to a servant, unquote. She was, quote, a woman who had something in her possession, unquote. And according to the historian, Amy Lewis Erickson, Louise Erickson, that something was capital. A mistress also exercised, quote, dominion, rule, or power, unquote. The term mistress did not signify a married woman's subservient legal position or a woman's subordinate status to that of a master. By definition, and in fact, the mistress was the master's equivalent. Thus, when South Carolina legislators declared that, quote, every master, mistress, or overseer shall and may have liberty to whip any strange Negro or other slave coming to his or their plantation with a ticket, unquote, the pass an enslaved person had to carry when he or she left the master's estate. They were not imbuing mistresses with subordinate powers or power in their husband's stead. They were recognizing the comparable powers and authorities and authority that these women possessed. My thoughts after reading that passage, I felt more inspired to refer to white women as mistress. When speaking with powerful white women, I might refer to them as mistress along with their last name, or refer to them as madam along with their last name, to be courteous and show the power and difference between us, since I am a victim of white supremacy. Also, the last time I called, I forgot to mention that the admitted white supremacist, known as Brendan Harrison Tarrant, the author of The Great Replacement Towards a New Society Manifesto, his original manifesto was 240 pages, but he deleted it, then began working on his published 74-page manifesto about 2 weeks prior to his terroristic attack on non-white people in New Zealand. This is all. Y'all stay safe out here and take care. Thank you.
White women, essential component in the system of white supremacy. Much of reading is more important than watching television. Thank you so much for sharing snippets, motivating me and hopefully others to get Miss Jones Rogers' text. See if we can get her as a guest on the program. Did we miss anyone? We have about 30 seconds. So if we missed anyone totally, or if someone has something they can get in 30 seconds. Oh, well, took too long. We will be here later this week. I'm looking forward to having a few days to try to settle, acclimate a bit. Moving is stressful as well. Do some yoga. Oh, my goodness, I forgot. Almost forgot. I did post it. John Singleton's family urges black men to get their blood pressure checked. Singleton's death is a reminder that black men are hit hardest by high blood pressure, a silent killer that often comes without symptoms or warning. I posted the report. The system of white supremacy is most to blame for all of this, but there are things that you can do. Diet, exercise, yoga, drinking more water. There are a lot of things that we can do that would help a lot to try to prevent that, because that's what the system of white supremacy is designed to produce. John Singleton dead at 51. Exactly. Standard operating procedure of racist man, racist woman, the mistress, and racist child, even the six-year-olds. With that, much obliged to everyone who participated. Hope it's been worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Dr. Welsing, many others. I think that would also help with the high blood pressure as well, to eliminate consumption of alcohol and cigarettes. Another one. Sobriety would be best for victims of racism. Let's do all that we can to preserve our brain computer so that we can come up with a permanent solution to the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle.
passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.